welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We're here, as always, to talk about stuff. This week on the show, Nintendo unveiled more details about their upcoming Nintendo Switch console in Tokyo, and then they had press events in various, I think it was in New York, right?
Yeah, there was one in New York, and I believe there's one in London as well.
Okay, yeah. So there's lots and lots of details that came out about the Nintendo Switch, including price, launch date, launch lineup, games throughout the year, and the thing is coming very soon, March 3rd. In case you hadn't heard, March 3rd for $299, although if you didn't pre-order it already, good luck with that.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about all that later. That will be our main topic. New console launch, that's always an exciting thing. So, and as I was just saying to you off the air, it's kind of nice to be in a console launch where the hype cycle is only really going to be like these 5 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Because the last time this happened, the PS4 and the Xbox One were both announced with a huge event like a year before they came out.
Right.
And then you had E3 like a couple of months after that. Here it was like we got that little like 5 minute video, and then like a month or two later we get this, and then a month or two later the console's just fucking out.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a couple months of rumors in there. But, I don't know, you can't really blame Nintendo for that necessarily.
Yeah, and that is maybe my the happiest thing about this whole event is that we can just stop living in this world of every single video game website just posting a billion Switch rumors every single day.
Yes.
Because I had no idea what anything about the Switch was. At some point, I just believed that the Switch was like a potato and wasn't a video game console at all because that's what the rumors were telling me. I'm glad that those rumors have been put to bed.
There were indeed a lot of rumors. So nothing else really major happened, I feel like, in entertainment news this week. So we don't have a lot to talk about there, but this is certainly a topic in and of itself.
Yeah.
But I have a stuff thing to talk about. What stuff things do you have to talk about?
Not a whole lot. I've been playing a little bit of Dynasty Warriors here and there, having fun with that. I started playing the Liu Bei campaign. He's kind of the good guy, because I was playing the Cao Cao stuff, and he's kind of the bad boy of Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And then I hit the point where I was up to in the book. I was like, I'll play one of the other campaigns and kind of get there, because you can kind of just play them all simultaneously. And so I'm still liking that. I've also been putting a lot of time into Hitman still, of that, like, now that there's not a lot of new content coming out, I can just go in, and I've been doing all the escalation contracts, which is something I just didn't have a lot of time to put into before, and those are a lot of fun.
I really like, I've only done a couple, but I really like the ones I've done.
Yeah, like, they really force you to rethink how you play the game, because it's basically, it's this fun little kind of challenge mode where they have a bunch of them on all the different maps, and it just gives you a sort of objective, like a target and a specific, generally it'll be like, oh, where, like, kill this one guy who could be like any random person on a map, basically. It does not have to be one of the main targets constructed for the map. And you have to kill this person with, like, wearing this disguise with this weapon. And then if you do that, then they will add things on top of it. Sometimes it'll be other targets. Sometimes it'll be the most fun thing is when they put weird modifiers on, like, oh, you can't pacify anyone. You have to kill someone or, like, leave them alone. Or they'll, like, hide dead bodies within 90 seconds, which that one has been the trickiest for me in some of the escalations. And right now I'm working on an escalation contract that I'm on the last one, the fifth one, because each one has sort of five stages. And it's a Sapienza one that's basically you have to kill a bunch of people with accident kills. And one of them is you have to do it with your suit. And on the last one, like, it's just a really hard sort of, like, trying to get all these things organized, and there was a modifier that made it so that, like, everyone can basically see through your disguises and stuff, and trying to sort of, like, the main way to kill them with accidents is to get a wrench and then, create an oil leak with all these motorbikes lining the street, and then wait for them to pass by and shoot them. And my favorite part about it is that since you basically have to kill at least one of the targets, you have to be wearing your, like, normal, like, standard, like, come into the map on the standard starting point suit kind of thing, that I have unlocked the Santa suit by playing the holiday map. So I'm just playing the whole thing running around as Santa Claus of, like, creating these oil leaks and blowing up these motorbikes and killing all these people.
Giving them a very different type of present.
Yes, exactly. And it feels so much fun. And one of the best parts is on the last stage of the escalation, they add this complication where you need to kill two of the targets now. You have to kill wearing the bodyguard uniform, and then one of them you have to kill wearing your starting suit. And so I start the map, and how I'm, like, working out this routine is I go and I run into the church, and if you go into the back of the church, it counts as a trespassing area, and that will cause the, like, a guy who's back there to go and run and grab a guard and bring him there to sort of get you out of the trespassing zone. And so that pulls a bodyguard in there. And so I'm a Santa Claus, and I kill him. And there's something so much fun about running into the back of the church, going up the stairs, and finding the dude who's back there, and just running into him, and him turning around and seeing you and being like, oh, God, and running away. And then I just slowly walk down the stairs after him with my silenced pistol out while he goes and gets the guard. And I'm just dressed as fucking Saint Nick the whole time on like in like this bright summer day in the middle of Italy. And then one time I shot the bodyguard and then put the disguise on and turned and look at that guy. And since he's in a church, he had this great line where he was just yelling, he's like, no, no, don't kill me, don't kill me. I'm like, Jesus, I help people, you can't kill me. And I let him live.
But, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's Hitman is a great, great game. And it's like I said before, it is the murder flower that gives more the more you take from it. And it's a great game.
I really feel like if they try another Hitman movie, it should be a Hitman Christmas movie.
Yes. With
basically that as the plot.
Yes, that would be it's so sad now that I've gotten really into Hitman and knowing that those two movies are fucking terrible, because there is a really fun kind of almost campy movie to be made out of Hitman that like is in there, you know?
I can't speak to the second film they made, but the first one with Timothy Oliphant, I the weirdest thing about that movie, looking back on it now that I've played the game too, is that it's so serious. Mm-hmm. Like, that film is so self-serious. It's the basic assassination movie plot where Hitman is framed and he has to, like, clear his name. But, like, the opening credits are all this stuff about, like, you know, Hitman as a kid being, like, torn away from his family and being turned into this. And it's, like, not in kind of the tongue-in-cheek way the games would handle it, but in this super serious way where, if you treat Agent 47 super seriously, he's just a dude with no personality.
Yeah.
If you treat him comedically, he's a dude with a very particular personality.
Yeah. He is like the ultimate cosmic straight man of comedy, you yes. know? Like, you can throw him into any scenario and he's completely stone-faced and he can just do whatever he needs to do and, like, say a really dumb sort of corny joke while he's doing it. He's great. Yeah.
Really, the best version of a Hitman movie would be like the Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, where it's just people doing a Let's Play of Hitman.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I have spent a lot of the past year watching a lot of different Hitman the movies, when you put it that way.
Yes, exactly. So, maybe one day they can just do that for the next one.
Yeah.
It would be a lot cheaper to produce.
Yeah, it definitely would.
Yeah. We have the technology to make that movie.
Yeah.
All right, well, anyway, glad you're enjoying that. I need to go back and play some of those escalation contracts. They are fun. How many is the Paris map up to?
They have it has so many. I just, because I've just been basically going through them kind of linearly, and I just last night finished all the Paris ones, and I've been working on those for like 2 weeks. There's nowhere near as many on the other maps. Like, there's quite a few on Sapienza. There's like 5 or 6, I think, on Marrakesh. And then there's like 2, 3, or 1 on the later ones, because obviously those are very new, and I'm there. Because they keep on adding escalation contracts like every other week, so
right.
they have been stacking them up for sure.
Yeah, whenever I look at the Paris ones, I'm just like intimidated because yeah. There's so many.
Yeah, there are two ones that take place on the two tutorial maps as well, and those are great.
I love
those. Like I didn't even like think to check those because I was going to pick the Paris one, and then I accidentally thumbed into that one first, and I was like, oh, maybe there are actually some on these maps, and I went all the way to the right. I was like, oh shit, there are. I had no idea.
That's when I actually first played the tutorial maps. I did everything, including the escalation contracts, with them.
Yeah.
And I really love those escalation contracts. Like, the one on the boat and then the one in the training facility are just fantastic. Yeah.
The one in the training facility was a moment where, for one of the stages of those, I realized you could do something that I never did before in that whole game, which is if you are standing on a ledge by a window, you can equip a gun and aim the gun into that room from the side. I had no idea you could do that. Like, it's one of those weird things about that game. I have played that game for like 50, 60 hours, and I've just never been in a scenario where like I needed to do something like that. And then in that escalation contract, it put me in this perfect spot where I was like, wait, I wonder if I could just shoot. And then I've like checked, I was like, oh my God, I can equip my silenced pistol and just pop this guy from this window, like get on this pole and just slide down and leave the map.
Yeah.
There's that game is just brilliant.
Yep.
I love it.
Speaking of brilliant games, I got two little things to talk. One little thing and one bigger thing to talk about. And one is my continued adventures with Persona 4 the Golden. Yes. Still enjoying my new game plus. Although, I'm getting to a point where it is ludicrous how easy some things are in that game in new game plus.
Yeah.
So I'm on like September 3rd.
okay,
of the game,
yeah,
in the in-game calendar.
You're getting there.
I am one social link event away from completing every nighttime social link.
Man, yeah.
So all I will have left to do at night is like either go grab fortunes or read books. And I do have a lot of books to read.
I mean, yeah, you trophy, can get that trophy to get the book reading trophy. Yeah,
but it is kind of funny. Like just, and I've also got hyper speed reading already read, so I can read each book in like one or two sittings.
Yeah.
So I am like a god in that game. Also, a lot of the social link events are incredible. Ones that I just never, like, there's one in particular I never even started, which was the tutoring social link.
Oh, really? Yeah.
In the game, which is the tower social link. And I love that social link because it's the tower card, which is the card of calamity.
Yeah.
And, you know, your ego crashing down. And I'm going through that, and it's about this kid, Shu. And for the most part, that is one of the more kind of dull social links in the game for a while. Because Shu is just kind of a sad kid who studies all the time.
Yeah.
And you're wondering, Where's the tower thing going to come in? What's going to happen? And when it comes, it's fucking intense.
Mm-hmm.
And that game kind of goes for it at that point, and it's some very powerful stuff that happens.
Yeah.
So that can be said for a lot of the social links. I also finished the nurse social link,
yeah,
which I don't think I ever finished the first time. And that social link is the devil social link. And that is a fascinating one because the whole idea behind the devil card is it's not just like Satan bad. It's the idea of you being in a scenario that is toxic to you, and this card signifying that you need to escape from that.
Yeah.
And you, for a while, you think you, Narukami, is the you to that reading.
It's his relationship with the nurse.
The nurse
who's toxic for him. Yeah.
Right. Who seems kind of inappropriate and all these things. And then as it goes along, you realize, well, he was going to be fine. He's a flirt anyway. And the nurse really is just doing that kind of as a defense mechanism. And you realize, actually, what is devil for her is being a nurse and being in this hospital setting where she is, like, such an empathetic person that she just cannot stand this. And there's so many things she hates about her life. And the social link, spoiler alert, culminates in her deciding to kind of uproot her life and leave. And, it's one of the only scenes in the game where Yu Narukami is kind of blown away by someone's actions, I feel like.
Yeah.
And kind of left, like, I've learned an important life lesson today. And it's a really fantastic one, too. Although now the game still tells me every, like, 3 days, you can work as a janitor tonight. And I'm like, there's no social link benefit, guys. I'm not doing that.
You could just go get money.
I could.
Like, there's in Persona 5, you can go work at this convenience store to go make money. And there's, like, there's one, like, side quest that you need to go there for once. But, like, you can always just go there to work. I'm like, why would anyone do this? There's no, like, there's no knowledge bonus or anything like that. There's no social link. You want to roleplay as this dude who has a part-time job at the convenience store, you can always go there.
I guess it's with the janitor one at the hospital, you do get a courage boost every time.
Yes.
But I don't need that anymore. And I really don't need any money. I am the richest person in Inaba at this point. I have an incredible amount of yen. Anyway, so Persona 4 Golden, it's good. You know that. I just wanted to share some more thoughts. Love that game. I'm getting close to the part of the game where you go meet and rescue Naoto. So I'm excited to get my full team finally.
Yes.
I forgot how deep it is into that game, which also means how much that game is left after you have your full team. That's a long game.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, love it. I've also been grinding a ton in that game.
Okay.
And I am ludicrously over-leveled. I am already level 60.
Yes,
it's just nuts. Like, but it's just kind of fun when you're that powerful to just kind of grind in that game and like do some Persona fusions because I'm getting close to, you know, finishing my compendium because I started this run with 75% completion. So I was pretty close anyway.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting to do that. And just I'm curious how the final dungeons will go when I'm probably going to like hit max level before the game's over. So yeah.
I mean, hopefully you can get Lucifer by the end of that and he has the special ability that basically nullifies everything about the Marie dungeon and the whole mechanic around that.
Yeah.
Man, that was fun. That was just so good, just walking into that and being like level 99, having this one guy who's like at the end of every single fight, all my HP and SP is completely restored. It's like, yep, here we go.
I'll keep Lucifer in mind for that.
Yeah.
It should be fun. Anyway, so that's fun. Other thing that's fun, although this is maybe a strange word on the surface to apply to this, is I have been watching Netflix's A Series of Unfortunate Events TV series, which went up on Netflix yesterday. We're recording this on Saturday, so Friday the 13th of January, which is an apropos date for that show.
Yes.
And I have to say, this is one of the most pleasant surprises I feel like I've ever had in the world of television. Yeah, I've
heard from a lot of places that this is very good.
It's spectacular. Like, I have to gush about this show because I love it to pieces. It's 8 episodes. I've watched 7. Oh, I was going to... I really burned through
it. Yeah, that was fast.
I was going to try to finish all 8 before this podcast, but then we moved the recording up and I couldn't quite finish all 8. But I've seen most of the season. It is a great show, and it's a pleasant surprise for me in a number of ways. One being that they have taken a stab at adapting Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events before in the 2004 film with Jim Carrey, and it wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't.
And they never made more of it. And then they put out a trailer for this Netflix show that I was, like, viscerally turned off by because I think it... And going back, I don't think it's that the trailer's misleading. I just think it highlights one particular side of the show and not the totality of it.
Okay, yeah.
Although in retrospect, I'm not sure how you cut a trailer for something this tonally complex. But anyway, you know, so I was kind of unsure. I was always going to check the show out anyway just because I was curious. But then, yeah, at the start of this week, basically, it's the reviews started pouring in, and they were pretty unanimously not just, this is pretty good, but this is like a really, really good show. From people who had read the books and people who hadn't. So I definitely wanted to check it out. And just as a little background, the books, which, if you don't know, came out between 1999 and 2006, and there are 13 of them, written by Daniel Handler under the pen name Lemony Snicket, which is a glorious pen name.
Yes.
And I read those books as they came out from the age of, like, 7 to 14, and I loved them. Those books are a huge part of my childhood. They taught me a lot of different things. Like, so much of my vocabulary comes from those books, because a big kind of gimmick in the books is it's constantly they'll say a big word, and then Lemony Snicket will say, a word which here means, and then he'll give an explanation. So he's constantly improving your vocabulary, which is wonderful. It's much more entertaining than just reading a dictionary.
I don't know. I've had some fun times reading dictionaries in my day.
Indeed. So Lemony Snicket would there's probably a joke somewhere in those 13 books of it would be more fun to read a dictionary, because one of the gimmicks also is he's constantly telling you to stop reading the books because they're too sad.
Yeah.
And anyway, I love those books. I think they're great. If you don't know the basic story, it's about the Baudelaire orphans, who are these three kids, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny. Sunny's a baby, and they lose their parents in a tragic fire, and in the first 7 books are shipped from guardian to guardian, their first guardian being the villainous Count Olaf, who's the leader of a really shitty theater troupe who wants their fortune, and in each of those first 7 books, he kind of attacks whatever guardian they have, and he has a disguise, and there's kind of this formula to it. And then the latter half of the series starts breaking that formula and gets even darker than the first half, which at certain points is hard to believe, because those books involve an awful lot of death for a children's series. We'll just say that. I mean, they start with a horrible fire that kills the parents and things like that. So, but those books are wonderful, but I think tonally they're a very tough thing to adapt, because they are funny, and they're very funny, but they are also extremely morose, and it's a really weird tone. Like, I was trying to think of the best way to describe it on the way over here, and it really is, it's like a screwball kind of comedy, but done in a Victorian tragedy setting.
Sure, yeah.
And that really is what Lemony Snicket was constantly going for. The 2004 movie sanded a lot of that down, had Jim Carrey giving a very silly performance as a very neutered Count Olaf. And it even ends with a happy ending where Lemony Snicket in the film says, "These children were very fortunate indeed." And you're like, yeah, that's not the tone of the books.
Yeah,
the books,
no.
There's just, spoiler for people who are coming with the TV series, there's not a happy ending at the end of book
13. Yeah, like that ending would be if it was a Victorian tragedy in that it was actually like written in like the late 19th century, not today.
Where it has a slapped on happy ending.
Yes, where like everyone gets married and everything's happy, and then but then like in the background you're always thinking like, but every fucked up thing that happened to this whole story has in no way been resolved by this.
Yeah.
But everyone's married, so it's fine.
But one of the interesting things about this TV show, which is on Netflix, so the Netflix has the first season, it's 8 episodes, and the plan is every book will be adapted into 2 episodes, so they're planning on doing 26 episodes total.
Cool.
This season is the first 4 books, so 4 two-parters. And the team behind the TV show, which is Daniel Handler himself, who wrote all the episodes, or co-wrote, so he's in charge, the author of the books, Barry Sonnenfeld, who's the director of films like Men in Black, and he was the original person attached to do the movie back in the day, and those two guys, and then some of the other people involved here, producers, were originally planning to make that movie in the early 2000s. Paramount Pictures they were like, this is too dark. They fired all those people, made a lighter movie, and Daniel Handler, he has never said he hated that movie, but he always said he's, you know, was unsatisfied with it and wanted to do more, and was sad they didn't get to kind of do his vision on film. And so finally, 10 years later, or 12 years later, like, one of the funny things is the girl who plays Violet in this was 1 year old when the movie came out. which is a sobering statistic.
Yeah, man.
Anyway, that's an amazing thing to me. But anyway, so that creative team kind of finally got to come back, do the TV show, and because it's on Netflix, pretty much with no restrictions and can do whatever the hell they want, and you can tell, including having an irresponsible budget. I've said this more and more about Netflix shows.
Yeah.
Netflix shows are irresponsibly budgeted. There is too much money up on screen.
Yeah.
It's really nice, but you start thinking like, I get distracted by thinking I don't understand how this business model works.
Exactly, yeah. I've had moments like that too, watching some original Netflix program. You're like, how the fuck are they, where are they getting the money to do this? Because it's like, because it's not just this, it's like, it's this, it's like, Lemmy Snicket's, it's fucking all the Marvel shows, it's Origins of Duplo. It's like they have so many shows ongoing. It's The Crown. Like, it's all this
movies.
Stuff. Yeah, all these movies that they're funding. It's like, I get that it, like, Netflix obviously is a very successful business, but it's like, is it this successful of a business?
It's very strange, because you're like, I only pay $10 a month for this.
Yeah.
It feels like I'm stealing it, but I'm not.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah, no, and definitely A Series of Unfortunate Events falls in that category of, they spent an awful lot of money on this. Like, it looks bigger budget and, like, better produced than the movie did 12 years ago, which is just insane. So, but where to start with the show? So, like I said, you know, very tough tone to go with, but you can tell basically from the moment the theme song starts in episode one that you are in good hands, because the theme song, which is just wonderfully addictive and creative, is Neil Patrick Harris as Count Olaf singing the song Look Away, and it's all about how you need to stop watching the show because it will ruin your whole life and your day, which is the kind of thing that Lemmy Snicket would write, where he would start with the big proclamation and then go for the minutia. So things like that. And then the middle verse of the theme song is specific to the episode and the story they're telling, and it's them singing about, like, the horrible things that are going to happen in this particular episode and why you need to look away. And it's just all, it's like, yes, I get it. And then the first scene of the first episode is Patrick Warburton perfectly cast as Lemony Snicket.
Okay,
we're talking, like, Alan Rickman as Snape levels of perfectly cast. Lighting a match in a dark tunnel, telling you that this is a very sad story, nothing happy will happen in it, and you have to stop watching. And I'm just like, yes, this is A Series of Unfortunate Events. And from that point on, I've been pretty giddy watching this show, because it is not exactly like the books, and that's something I really like about it, is that Daniel Handler, this is clearly one of those circumstances where he got to adapt his own material and decided, I'm going to have fun with this. Like, I get to go tell my story again, but I'm not just going to tell the same story. I'm going to do some different things here and there. And as the season goes along, actually, that becomes a bigger and bigger part of it, is how he's kind of consciously playing with the material. And if you've read the books, there's a lot of little Easter eggs and things like that. So he's having a lot of fun with that. But on top of that, it just feels like the books did, even if it's not always true to the letter of them. So, you know, a great example of that is kind of the person you have to talk about first with this show, which is Neil Patrick Harris as Count Olaf. He's top billed. He's on all the posters and stuff. And from that trailer, I was kind of thinking, that just kind of looks like the Jim Carrey approach, where you have kind of a comedic actor doing a lot of makeup and silly voices and stuff. And it is that, and I think if I were to just describe the performance on paper, it would sound a lot like what Jim Carrey was doing. But this is different in a couple of significant ways. And I think the main thing is that the TV format allows Neil Patrick Harris to show more shadings of this character than Jim Carrey got to do in a 90-minute movie, where they were trying to cram in three books and all these different costumes and stuff. And so Jim Carrey kind of just got to do the silly side of it. Neil Patrick Harris gets to the silly side, and he revels in it, and he is screamingly funny at times. This is Neil Patrick Harris. This is the ideal version of Neil Patrick Harris. This is him at his best, and he is wonderful. But he also gets to have those other shadings like I talked about, including being genuinely menacing at moments, which is what that character has to be if you're going to sustain 13 books where he's the main villain.
Right.
If he's just a goofball, there's kind of no reason to read it. But he's a goofball who also, through the first season, murders like 10 people on screen, you know, often pretty brutally. And it is kind of wonderful that there's, I just got through the end of the sixth episode, it's the end of the third book. And if you've read the books, you know, there's a particularly gnarly murder committed at that point in the story by Count Olaf. And the way they realize it on screen is like the perfect version of this realized, because it is walking that line between being really macabre and dark and also very, very black comedy and very dark and kind of hard, and you're laughing at it, but you feel bad for laughing at it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think Neil Patrick Harris ultimately was just kind of the perfect actor for this in so many ways, and I really appreciate his performance, and he's not even my favorite part of the show, so that just tells you how many good things they did. But, like, the overall design of the series is wonderful, from the makeup to the production design to the cinematography to the costumes to the music and all those different things, like, especially because Game of Thrones is actually not going to be eligible for Emmys this year because it's airing too late in the year. If Netflix cannot get a series of unfortunate events to sweep the technical categories at the Emmys, they need to stop trying to win Emmys because they're never going to win Emmys. This is like, Beau Welch is a famous production designer who's worked on lots of Hollywood movies, and he's the production designer here, also directs a couple of episodes, and he might have been the production designer on the movie as well back in the day because it's got a similar production design, but they were clearly able to go further with it. And the overall look of this show is so magnificent. It's like, every frame and every set is so ridiculously detailed. It just kind of boggles your mind. I was joking about like the Netflix budget of it, and that's definitely part of it.
Yeah.
It's also just like the man hours that had to go in to making this room that is in like one shot of the show, but is so beholden to that kind of off-kilter Victorian architecture that the books kind of go for.
Yeah.
I love it. It looks so gorgeous. And then the makeup, what I was going to say with Neil Patrick Harris is that his Count Olaf, I didn't quite see it when I saw the trailer, but once you get extended time with him in the show, the makeup on Count Olaf is literally what he looks like in the Brett Hellquist illustrations in the books. Like, to where his unibrow is, how far his hair goes out, it's exactly what, if you grew up reading those books, what you saw Count Olaf as in every illustration, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of fun, obviously, with all his different disguises, and I like kind of this underlying theme with how they characterize Count Olaf, which is that he's a shitty actor, and they really lean into that side of his personality, where he's a shitty actor who thinks he's a great actor, and part of why he seems to do all these schemes where he plays dress-up is just because he wants to play dress-up mm-hmm. and impress people with his bad performances. And of course that goes to one of the larger themes of the story, which is that adults are sort of idiots and just accept what is ever thrown at them, and so he's constantly fooling people who are stupid. And it really feels like Daniel Handler, you know, he knows his own books. He knows his shit. He knows how to do this. So I'm kind of scrambled here. There's so many good things about this show. But just to talk about some of the other characters, for instance, Violet and Klaus, the main two kids in the show, are played by these two kids, Melina Weissman and Lewis Hines. And Melina Weissman I knew from a couple of things. She's plays young Supergirl on Supergirl whenever you do a flashback. So I'd seen her in that. And Lewis Hines, though, is an unknown. And they're both fantastic. Like, obviously the child actor thing is a tough thing to do, and this is a TV series, so they have to hold together a lot of this, but they are both so good. And I think one of the things that works is that they're actual kids. Like, I think Melina Weissman is 13 and I think Lewis Hines is younger than that, and just that they come across as actual little kids who have this incredible burden on them, I think makes the story function better. I don't remember the ages of the kids in the movie, but they were obviously, you know, a little older in terms of what they were playing, and that just, it's kind of like when you see, what's his name, play Spider-Man.
Andrew Garfield.
Not Andrew Garfield, I meant
Tobey Maguire?
I meant the new Spider-Man, sorry. Anyway,
yeah. I've suspended all the actors I can name.
That's okay, but I was going to say, like, versus Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield,
right,
when you see the actual Spider-Man played by a kid, you're like,
yes,
that's authentic.
Yes, and like that weird awkwardness feels right.
Yeah, but those kids are great. They basically are the straight man and woman of the series, and they do that really well. And, like, particularly the kid who plays Klaus is such a find, I think, because he, not to take anything away from the girl who plays Violet, I've seen her in other stuff, but Lewis Hines as Klaus, he has this, just existential indignation at everything in this show because things go so horribly wrong so fast and everyone is such an idiot. And he plays that particular note so well that I feel like you get out of the books and did not come across at all in the 2004 movie or most stories about kids on screen who wind up being precocious in a very different way.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I love all of that. Like, they do have an actual baby playing Sunny, and I think it's funny that they actually credit her in the theme song, because you don't normally credit babies like that.
Yeah.
But that seems nice, even though this child will never remember any of their time playing this character, which has to be a weird thing when they grow up.
Yeah, when you're, like, 30 years old or something, and you're still, like, weirdly famous if this gets, like, really popular.
It's like the Nirvana baby, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's like, I was not conscious when I took that picture, but it's defined my entire life.
Yeah.
But anyway, they do a lot of good with Sunny here, too, because I think in the movie she was just kind of there as, like, something a prop in scenes. But here, like, Sunny is a character who has the... They do the thing in the books where she says, like, baby gibberish, and they subtitle it with her crazy sentences. And it's wonderful. And I even saw in the credits, the voice of Sunny is Tara Strong. Which is such a funny,
that's,
like...
Okay, that's really good.
Yeah, just that you would go out of your way to get one of the best voice actresses out there
yeah.
to play the baby voice of Sunny. That's just a wonderful credit in
that's
the episode.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah, so that's great. So Sunny gets to be an actual character. So all those characters are great. And then in terms of the adult cast, it's just... You're tearing through great actors with this show. One of the most impressive performances is Mr. Poe, who is the character... He's basically the executor of the Baudelaire's estate. So he is constantly right, yeah. trying to get the Baudelaire's into, like, their new guardians' homes. And he's constantly putting them in danger because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
That is, I think, probably the hardest role in the entire series to do on film because it is so thankless in a way. And the actor who's playing him, K. Todd Freeman, who you would recognize him. He's kind of a famous character actor. He's wonderful. Like, he makes that character so much funnier and more interesting than I think he was even in the books, where he's really just the dude who keeps... He's a plot device in the books.
Yeah,
he's the guy who keeps fucking up and getting the Baudelaires in danger. And instead, I think Mr. Poe in this fulfills that plot function, but is also a good source of humor and dramatic irony in this story. I already mentioned Patrick Warburton. He was put on this earth to play this part, and he is so great. And the way they use him, where he's constantly just walking in and out of scenes, being Lemony Snicket, you know, just you'll cut back to him in, like, his hidden lair where he has to leave because the authorities are coming to capture him, and he's got all these, like, conspiracy walls and things. He is so funny, and I love an excuse to listen to Patrick Warburton's voice for 8 solid hours. He is a cool dude. And then there are some other actors that really surprised me, like Uncle Monty, their second guardian in the book The Reptile Room, is played here by Asif Mandvi from The Daily Show, is what you guys probably know him as. And he's done some other, like, dramatic, comedic acting roles, but I haven't seen him in a lot of that. So he was a real surprise here, because he's very good in this. He's very funny, but he also is very warm and human in a way you wouldn't necessarily expect, you know, someone you know for being a fake news anchor on The Daily Show to be. And I really loved his part in this. Their third guardian, Aunt Josephine, is played by Alfre Woodard, who is another just great character actress, and she is magnificent in this, playing very much against type, because Alfre Woodard plays women, I feel like, who typically have their shit together, and Aunt Josephine very much does not have her shit together, and she's very funny at that. And I've just started that, the final two-parter, but there's a couple of good actors there. Don Johnson plays a guy in those last two episodes. Rhys Darby from Flight of the Conchords and some other stuff plays a character who is a very funny background element of this show. And then you have all the actors in Count Olaf's theater troupe who are really just his minions, and I don't know their names, but they are all very funny and a kind of more constant presence than I ever realized they were, because they're used the same way they are in the books, but in the books they don't really come across as characters, and they do a good job with that in the series. So the acting across the board is so good. I love the production design. I love the music. James Newton Howard, they got to do the music. Big Hollywood composer. Again, I'm like, where'd they get the money for that, Netflix? But he really might be the thing that ties it all together the most, because finding the right music for this kind of tonally all over the map thing is a tough thing to do, and James Newton Howard nails it, and it is a score with a truly incredible amount of accordion in it, as a show like this needs a truly incredible amount of accordion.
Okay, yeah, and that works.
If you want to see a modern American TV show with the accordion as its primary instrument in the score, you can go watch A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix, and I feel like that's the highest praise I can give the show. But I love it to pieces. I think the scripts are very good. It's the rare Netflix show where it doesn't feel like every episode is way too long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them are long. They kind of vary in length. I think the second episode is an hour, but then, like, the third episode is 43 minutes or something.
Right, yeah.
So they vary, but they generally feel like that's the length they need to be. I think it's interesting how they generally follow the stories from the books, but Daniel Handler is having fun, like I said, rewriting certain parts. The fourth book gets a pretty big overhaul because both it's the end of this season, and that is one of the weaker books in the original series, so he kind of really reworks how that one functions. But then also he really leans into the mystery stuff from the books, which was kind of largely excised from the film when that was made. But that is one of the best things about those books, is there's this whole mystery of this mysterious organization called VFD that the Baudelaire's parents and Count Olaf apparently were in together at one point. And really, the mystery is this just giant red herring that goes throughout the entire books, and even some of the side books that Lemony Snicket wrote, like the wonderfully titled Lemony Snicket, The Unauthorized Autobiography, which was a very funny side book that came out. And you can tell he always had fun writing those things in the books, and he has fun kind of expanding it here. There's a lot more of that mystery stuff going on, and I just love it. It's so funny. They get so many good actors to come in and just do their thing in the background as different VFD members, basically. And you get Daniel Handler coming up with more ways to integrate the acronym VFD, which just stands for a million different things over the course of the series. And he's already come up with a bunch of new ones that aren't even in the books. So it is just a blast. It's a terrific adaptation. It is, the highest praise I can give it is as good of this kind of thing, of like an adaptation of a young adult novel, as I have ever seen. I would put it up there with like the Harry Potter movies or something. It is really well done. And my biggest complaint is I'm really mad there's only 8 episodes to start and I have to wait for the rest. Because I'm at episode 7, so I'm about to watch the finale. It doesn't feel like I'm at the end of a season. It feels like I'm about, you know, a third of the way through the series. And I kind of, part of me wishes they could have done something crazy and just, like, made all 26 episodes and put them out at once and just let you watch them.
Would have been unreasonable.
It would have been unreasonable, but it's definitely that kind of thing where it's a hard thing to kind of split into discrete seasons, and it probably will be a while before we get more. But luckily, they only need 2 more seasons to make the rest of it, so it's not like the kids are going to get too old or anything. This should work. Netflix, I don't think, has ever canceled a show. So,
I mean, Netflix does not go around canceling shows. Netflix goes around uncanceling shows.
That's true.
Is what they have made their business on.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we can feel confident that they're going to make the rest of this. It's just that it might take a while to see it all, and that makes me sad because it is very good. But, like, I'm probably going to have to go back and find my books wherever they are and read some of those again because I remember generalities about the back half of the series, which is where it gets weird, frankly. But I would like to see some of that again and then see. I'm very curious how they're going to adapt the second half of the book series because it already feels like they're making some little changes that are going to pretty dramatically affect where they're going with it. But I also kind of trust that this is the right path for the adaptation because Daniel Handler clearly knows what he's doing. So I'm very curious to see where this goes. There, you know, this stops right before kind of the best run of the books. So excited for season 2. But this is a great show. I can't recommend it highly enough. As kind of the first new show I've seen in 2017, it's a good start to the year. Not that TV stops at any point these days.
Yeah. Especially like Netflix is, like, do you even really call it TV? Like, what is it at some point?
I don't know. And that's actually, if I had any other complaint, I don't understand why there are discrete episodes of this thing. So each book is 2 episodes, but that's basically just so that you can have like hour-long chunks. Why? Why not just have 4 TV movies and just that's the adaptation of the book? And if it's 90 minutes, it's 90 minutes. If it's 2 hours, it's 2 hours. It's kind of weird because that means every other episode when they start a new book has a very specific format to it, which I won't spoil. But it means those off episodes, the part 2s, kind of lack that. And it just feels like you kind of hit the pause button and then you come back. And it's one of those things with the Netflix model where I think it's done wonderful things. I also am like, you don't have to make hour-long episodes. It's Netflix. Do whatever you want with it. And that's just one of those things where I'm a little weirded out. But then you get to hear the theme song twice as often, so whatever. It's
like, I wonder if it was just because, like, they have data that says that people are more willing to start watching something if they see it is, like, an hour or 45 minutes long as opposed to seeing, like, oh, this is 2 hours long. And that's, like, psychologically, that is a much bigger time commitment of, like, sitting down to watch a chunk of like time that is a TV show and sitting down that's a chunk of time that is a movie is 2 psychologically very different experiences. And I think that might be something to do with it.
No, and that makes sense. It's just something where I was a little jarred the first time because you get to the end of that first episode and you're halfway through the book and that's like, well, I'm not going to stop now. I got to watch more. So, but yeah, it's really good for material that is very near and dear to my heart, but that I also thought could never really be adapted well on film. This is impressive and adds more fuel to the fire that books should go to TV more than they should go to movies.
Generally a more similar sort of model, especially if you're doing like a miniseries kind of thing like Netflix does.
Yeah, and I mean, at one point, you know, including when the movie of Series of Unfortunate Events was originally made, there was just no way you could launch that on TV. The budget, the audience just wasn't going to be there. Now you can do book series like Game of Thrones and Series of Unfortunate Events and things like that that would never really work in movie form on TV, and there is the budget and the audience for that, and that's a cool thing.
Yeah, it's such a brilliant thing that Netflix and then a lot of like HBO and stuff or Showtime with like Twin Peaks, like we're in this era where TV shows or like whatever Netflix shows can be whatever they need to be, and it can just be this, like, fucking crazy, like, grown-up version of Power Rangers, which is what Daredevil felt like half the time with, like, you know, these elaborate kung fu martial arts scenes and stuff like that. Or you can have, like, this, like, it's like pseudo-blaxploitation-style show with Luke Cage. Or you can have, like something, like, so crazy and tonally weird, like, a series of unfortunate events. Like, it's just so all over the place. Or, like fantasy movies, which is what Game of Thrones is. And yeah. It can be its own miniseries.
Another one that I'm sure we're going to be talking about later this year is Brian Fuller's adaptation of Neil Gaiman's American Gods for which Stars. Yeah,
something that, like, I read that book, and I should probably reread that book before that series comes out. And, like, that is something that, like, could not normally be adapted into a TV show. Like, I would never have thought could have been adapted, like, 10 years ago or something, you know, in that climate.
Interesting fun fact, tying this all together, the then young woman who played Violet in the original series of Unfortunate Events, Emily Browning, is one of the stars of American Gods, coming out this year.
Cool.
So they've had a good batting average with the kids from those movies, because I think the kids from this are also going to be stars at one point. Yeah. So, yeah. Good stuff. They let Neil Patrick Harris sing both in the theme song and out of it.
Which is like, if you're going to get Neil Patrick Harris, like, come on. Like,
let him sing, yeah.
Yeah, that's like half the reason you get the man.
Indeed, and yeah, I hope they get to keep that up, because Count Olaf gets both sillier and more scary as the books go along, and I'm actually, as much as I enjoy watching his stuff in these early stories, I am so much more excited to see what he does when Count Olaf frankly becomes a meatier character in the second half of the books. And I just, there's so much potential here, and I think Netflix is going to have a pretty substantial hit on their hands with this.
Awesome.
So, can't wait until they go back and readapt the Harry Potter books as a 200-episode maxi-thon one day.
I want what I have always wanted out of Harry Potter, which is just to make it into a fucking anime, which is what it should have been the whole time. It's about a kid going to a school, learning magic, like, and having love triangles and shit. It is already an anime, and J.K. Rowling just never even knew it. God
that,
damn it.
That would indeed be wonderful if one day, like, a Japanese anime company could get the rights to Harry Potter and just go crazy with it.
Yes, man. It would be so brilliant.
I can't wait until Harry gets into a mech.
Yes, exactly. Like, I can't wait until, like, the whole end of the show, like, takes place in this, like, abstract reality because they have destroyed the universe or something. And it's, like, Harry Potter and Voldemort just looking over, like, this abstract representation of time and space itself and having a philosophical argument.
Hagrid would totally be a midget in a robot, right?
Yeah, it's... That's... Yeah. All right. I think eventually, like, Ron Weasley would just pilot Hagrid.
Hagrid would be an acronym,
yes. Yeah. And it's just this giant mech. Yeah.
All right. Hideaki Anno, get on that.
Yes, please.
Once you're done with the Evangelion movies.
Yeah, so, like, 50 years from now.
Yes. He's technically only got one left. But anyway.
He's only had one left for a while now.
Yeah. All right, well, that's a series of unfortunate events. I wanted to talk about it. It's a wonderful show. Let's go ahead and move on and talk about our main topic today, which is...
Yeah, let's switch to our next topic.
They were very proud of that joke at the press conference.
They made it a lot.
Yeah. That was... it's interesting. We have not talked about this at all, so I'm interested to hear your thoughts. But that press conference, basically, it was Thursday night. It's kind of weird that they aired it, like, late at night, especially if you were on the East Coast. You were up
I mean, it was, like, afternoon in Japan. Oh, it was 1 o'clock in Japan as the YouTube stream kept on switching to the Japanese text. It's like, this is going to start at 1 p.m. in Japan. It's like, I can read that, motherfuckers.
I hadn't thought of that. Anyway,
technically, it was 1300 o'clock.
Interesting. So, anyway, late night for the States over here, and it was the announcement of, as I said, you know, the price and the specs and all those different things. They announced a bunch of games and reintroduced a bunch of games and all that stuff. Had some fun teasing out the date of Breath of the Wild. But it's interesting to me. I watched that press conference. Mm-hmm. I had to start about 15 minutes late, but I saw it, and I thought there was a lot of cool stuff. There was a lot of, you know, kind of boring, just normal press conference things to me. There were a lot of very Nintendo-y things about it, but overall, I came out at that pretty pumped about the state of this console. And there was a lot of negative reaction online, and some of it was just people complaining to me, which about things that to me are just sort of either normal console launch things or normal Nintendo like direct press conference things, like people bitching about the translators or something, which was weird.
See, I mean, yeah, that's not a complaint about the Switch thing. There were a couple of places where like the translators did not do a great job, but that's also like insanely hard to do.
Well, people went off script. What are they supposed to do? Yeah,
It was Suda 51.
Yeah.
You're not getting Suda 51 on a script. That man's insane.
No. So, I thought it was fine. I thought they showed a lot of good stuff, and I was happy about it. I don't know. Where were you coming from?
I am more on the negative side. Like, I don't think it was, like... It certainly was not a disaster or anything, but I definitely... I came into that, and I watched the whole press conference because, like I said, like I was watching the YouTube stream before it actually started, so I could see the Japanese text and all that stuff. But I came into it fairly positive on the Switch stuff, and like feeling like, oh, this might be like the one, like this might be what gets me back into Nintendo consoles. Like, it certainly has the potential. Like, I really liked a lot of the stuff about their sort of basic pitch when they did that first video, and we talked about all of that on the podcast when that came out. And then as the press conference went on, I kept on just feeling like nothing they are showing me is making me come out of the other side of this thing more positive on the Switch than I was going into it. That there's the, like, I've like, you know, the, some of the Mario stuff they showed like looked kind of cool, but I already knew this Mario game was going to come out. And like any of the, all the other, or most of the other new games were all just sort of like so far out in the future in abstract concepts almost, with so few details that it was just like, none of these games I can get excited about. I don't even know if some of these games are even going to be exclusives or not. Like some of that information was very unclear. And then there was a whole pile of a lot of information and things they were talked about that just really bummed me out about the Switch. Of like, this felt like me going into it, I felt like maybe this was Nintendo sort of switching gears and kind of changing their strategy and how they operated on some things. And that was what a lot of that, like, that really slick video indicated, was, like, felt like a kind of, in some ways, un-Nintendo-like video. Like, in other ways, it was very Nintendo, but in some ways, it was, like, how slick and modern and sort of savvy it felt. It was, like, this does not feel like Nintendo in a lot of ways. And then coming into this press conference and all the stuff of, like online services and all that kind of shit, it just kept on feeling like, oh, and like all the stuff with the Joy-Con controllers, that this is Nintendo again doing what Nintendo does, which is like overcomplicating things, going into like down weird rabbit holes that kind of lead nowhere in terms of their hardware, and just like alienating the vast majority of like the video game developer community with a lot of the choices they make with their console. Give me some, just, it bummed me out.
Give me some specifics, because I didn't feel that. So
I mean, basically, I think there, when you look at, like, there were practically no third-party developers in any way on there. Like, you had EA say, like, we're making FIFA, or we're putting FIFA out on this, it's going to be an old version of FIFA. You had the Square Enix Octopath game, which, like, is another one that was like, I have no idea if that's going to be exclusive to Switch, when that's going to come out. It looked cool, but, like, there's so little information about it that it's hard to get excited about that. There's, like, also, like, the untitled Shin Megami Tensei game is, like, who knows when that's going to come out. Like, there were no real surprises in terms of the game lineup, and any, like, small ones, like the Octopath one that were there, were so abstract and off in the future that it's, like, who knows if that game's even going to come out, when it's going to come out, on, like, what consoles are going to be coming out, and, like, what it's even really going to be, because we just got such a small window. And there was a lot of time they spent with, like, having Suda 51 on stage, like, regardless of how the translator handled it, talking very abstractly about, like, I want to make a game for the Nintendo Switch. And so there's a lot of time on there of, like, showing, like, really brief teasers for games, or talking, or people talking about games that they want to make on the console that are, like, in the very early stages of pre-production, that felt like there's, like, no games on this thing. And the games that are there are generally, like Zelda is a fucking Wii U game. It's like, you have your Mario game, and that's coming out holiday 2017. That's basically a year from when the console launches. And so it just felt like, if you own a Wii U, I don't see, like, what real impetus there is to get this thing at launch. And that was kind of, like, what I came away from it from, was like, the only thing that is attractive about this console basically at all feels like Zelda. And if I really, really want to play Zelda that bad, I can find a used Wii U for, like, $80 online. Like, that would be a much better path, I feel like, for me, if, like, that was reviewed. Because there's also, like, five or six Wii U games in the backlog that I would like to play, like a Super Mario Maker or Bayonetta 2. And, like, they did not convince me in any way that this was a console I wanted.
Okay. I mean, I'm coming at this from a fundamentally different angle. Which
I mean, I think it's something where our two positions on Nintendo are fairly different as well. And, like, so because you've been on board the Nintendo train
my whole life.
Yeah, your whole life, whereas, like, I fell off of it. And I think it says something that, like, this, what this presentation needed to do was to get me back on board the Nintendo train, not to, like, have the people that have stuck with them and bought Wii U's to stay with Nintendo. They need people to come back. And I felt like it did not feel like it did that for me. And in a lot of the reception online, I think people had a lot of the same issues when I, after okay. I went off and I looked online at, like, how people are talking about it. like, I agree with the general sentiment of, like, the disappointment around a lot of the stuff they announced.
I mean, I'm psyched about this. There's the hardware itself, I think, looks very slick. I like everything they've shown about that. You talked about some of the stuff with the Joy-Cons. They spent a lot of time talking about that. I think that control setup looks cool. To me, what it comes down to is I feel like with the Switch, and I'll talk about the game lineup later. Yeah. I agree with some of that, and I disagree with some of that. But it feels like they have found a way with the Switch, and this is what I was kind of thinking after that first announcement trailer, to make a space where they can do their fun, silly Nintendo-y gimmicks, like the 2-1 Switch, the
1-2 Switch.
1-2 Switch, the ARMS game, things like that, the Wii Sports kind of things.
Yes.
And they have a system that can support that, and they can do that if they want, but it also does not feel like the system is sacrificing anything in terms of games that are deeper and you can play more with. That you can absolutely play a full game like a Zelda or a Mario or something without motion controls or any of that with the Joy-Cons. They are not made in such a way that they force you to do that and use that.
They are made in such a way that they rack up the price of that console and rack up the price of other controllers you might want to buy for that console. And that's like, that's what I mean when it's like, it feels like you're going to, they're going to make 1-2 Switch. They're going to make ARMS, obviously, and those are going to come out like around the launch of the console, and like maybe a couple of other small games, and then Nintendo's not going to do fucking anything with those because Nintendo never does anything with those things.
Yes, they do. I will defend this. I think we have gotten too negative on those kind of things with Nintendo because of the gamepad on the Wii U.
What about the fucking Wiimote? Like,
they consistently used that throughout the lifespan of it, and it wasn't
like,
always the best thing.
What about
thing?
Like Super Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, Super Mario Galaxy? Like the one
Mario Galaxy does. I went back and replayed. I was surprised by, I think, how integrated that is into Mario Galaxy.
I mean, people are playing that with normal controllers on emulators, you know? Like, their control stuff with motion controls and stuff have never really been necessary, with the exception of, like, Skyward Sword is the one big first-party Nintendo game I can think of on the Wii that really used that, other than Wii Sports, obviously, at the launch.
Wii Sports did a huge job to sell that system to the
game. Yeah, but like, that was the one game, and those people didn't buy those games.
Okay, I mean, just because Nintendo also made games that didn't use those things does not mean that was an abject failure completely. I do think there is an idea of having that feeling more accessible to a larger audience and thinking of games in a way that are not just sitting down with your normal Xbox controller, that did do something huge for Nintendo there, did something huge for them with the Nintendo DS, where that second screen has consistently been a boon for that thing.
The
and
DS
I will defend
is where
it day I die.
Yeah, no, I will absolutely. The DS is obviously where it worked because they stuck with it with the 3DS. But I do think, like, this is not to say that, like, the Wii, I'm not saying the Wii was a failure. Like, obviously, it was a huge success in terms of its sales. But I think Nintendo very quickly, and this, I feel like this has happened basically with everything since the DS, they hit a point where they realize they, like, the people making the games don't really want to support whatever control gimmick it was. Like, in the Wiimote, other than Skyward Sword, was, like, never an integral part of their game design.
But I do think a fundamental difference between that is there are just games you cannot port to a Wii because of what the controls are there, and that won't exist on the Switch because the controllers have everything you would need to play a Skyrim or a Call of Duty or something like that.
Yeah, now, but if you're not going to make that many games that are going to support this gimmick, I think it's going to be, it's going to harm the console overall because, like, potentially this thing could have come in at a $250 price point if you didn't have all that stuff that is expensive, putting that into the technology of your controllers. Like, the Joy-Cons cost $80 to get another set of two of those Joy-Cons, and the Pro Controller costs $70, which is $10 more than a DualShock 4 and an Xbox One controller. And it's like, at some point, that price stuff piles up enough that it drags the console down and it changes the conversation about the console. The conversation about the Nintendo Switch would be completely different if it was a $250 console versus a $300 console. And making those sort of hardware changes, like, that's where you get the price down. And I feel like they're not going to see a lot of, like, really compelling, brilliant experiences using those Switch controllers, the Joy-Cons, especially because that runs completely contrary to a whole part of how that thing is supposed to work, which is you're supposed to be able to, like, take it on a bus with you, and those games are not going to work in that kind of context of it being this, like, fully portable device. You're not going
to... But that's one context of it. I do think there are interesting things like being able to just pass out two Joy-Cons and do a split-screen game on the Switch in that kind of setting. I think that's an interesting idea. I think
it's an interesting idea, but how many games are they going to make that actually do something?
I don't know, because it's not out yet, Sean.
I mean, I feel like if you look at the track record of Nintendo, it tends to be that they're not going to use that kind of stuff. That, like, maybe you will have, like, obviously Mario Kart will be cool. It'll be cool with something like Mario Kart that is a very simple to control game that only needs basically two or three buttons and then a, like, directional input that you can have take off the Joy-Con and play split screen that way. But all the stuff of, like, the gyroscope and the, like, sensor on the bottom of one of the Joy-Cons and all that stuff that is the actual more expensive stuff that's in those controllers that raises the cost of them, like, that's stuff that they're not going to use. Like, they just... because they have had that stuff in controllers in the past and haven't really used them.
Okay. I mean, as someone who's actually owned these Nintendo consoles and used them for their entire lifespans.
I have a Nintendo Wii. And okay. One of the reasons why I didn't use it that much is because I felt like they didn't make that many games that interested me that much on it. Like, I do feel like it is something that the original pitch of the Nintendo Switch that got me excited about it was that it was like this very sort of meat and potatoes kind of game device that had this cool, elegant core gimmick to it, which was that you can put it in the slot and then it's on the TV and then you can just take it off and immediately take it with you anywhere.
That's still the case.
And that is still the case. And now it has been dragged down by all this other weird focus of, like, here's all, like, the HD rumble in the controllers and the fucking sensor at the bottom and like, all this, like, weird shit and, like, these straps and all this. And they're showing all these games that, to me, look like they're commercials for games that we saw on the Kinect in, like, fucking 2010. And it's like we have regressed back to that point instead of focusing on moving forward with, like, kind of new ideas in games instead of going back to these ideas have moved on and are working in, like, virtual reality now and are not, like... We've found a place for those sorts of input mechanics, and that's in virtual reality. That's where it works really well. It's, like, not with these games. It feels weird that Nintendo is going back to that stuff.
I mean, every controller has... I think some of this is a double standard on, like, some of those things that you're saying is giving some of the gyroscope and HD rumble stuff. Every controller gets announced with silly shit like that. The DualShock 4 has a capacitive touchpad and a light bar that do nothing. And are drain on the battery, like, life and the performance
and
of that
those
controller.
Two things are... I mean, I think the touchpad is just, like, an underused element of that controller that, like, it can just be used as sort of a simple input device that can replicate multiple button presses that I wish more developers did more with. The light bar is a bad design choice on that controller. I'm not sitting here saying that it's a good one there.
But what you just described is how I would describe a lot of the sort of... those things that go into different Nintendo control devices, like on the Wii U or on the game or on the Wii with the Wiimote or on the gamepad, like having a touchscreen in your hands or having something you can just move around. Most of the time, were the games built around that 100%? No. Was it a little quality of life thing that helped that console in certain ways? To me, and I think to a lot of people who played it, yes. So I don't see why those little things can't be worked in. And I agree the price of the accessories is silly, and I would be interested to see if they do something with that. The price of the console itself didn't so much bother me. That's fairly low for a new home console, especially if you consider that's a starting point that they're going to cut to at some point.
I mean, it depends on what context you're looking at it, if you're looking at it as a home console or if you're looking at it as a handheld, right?
They're pitching it, I think, as a home console that you take with you, not a portable you put on your TV.
Yeah. But, like, I just think that when you're looking at, like, where the market is of, like, that the PS4 and the Xbox One are both $300 with frequent sales and they all come with bundles of other games, and the Nintendo Switch does not have a pack-in game at all, then we'll talk about that when we talk about the 1-2 Switch game, that, like, that's... I think, like, the market they're coming into, like, that is the highest price that they can be at. And I'm not saying that $300 is an unreasonable ask for the Nintendo Switch. I'm saying that what I said when we watched that trailer is that if this thing came in at $250, that would be such an amazing price point, and that would be one big thing for me to be like, okay, maybe I will actually get this thing, instead of, like, me looking at this and being like, oh, well, fuck. Because for me to actually get this console, I would have to put down $360 to get the game, to get the console and Zelda. And then probably I would want a pro controller on top of that, which is another $70. Like, that's a lot of money that I'm not going to just put down to play one game until Mario comes out, you know? Like, okay. And that's to me, that's, like, the story of this whole presentation was, like, I was not 100% sold on this thing, and every single thing they told me pushed me away from, like, the point I was of, like, being like, I might get this, and it was like, no, like, it was a lot of small decisions that stacked up to be like, there's no way I'm buying this at launch.
Okay.
Yeah,
I have mine pre-ordered, so that's we'll see.
You own a Wii U, Jonathan. I know, you're the guy who's going to get the Nintendo console.
I'm not saying that
they
like
didn't need to convince you with
no. And I was just going to say that to say that's where everyone was wondering. Yeah. No, I understand that, and I don't know. I mean, there were things that definitely got me more excited for it. I got distracted from this point. The point I was making earlier was just that. Yeah, we're coming at this from fundamentally different perspectives. To me, you know, I'm going to own Nintendo systems because Nintendo's batting average is higher than anyone else's on their actual games they publish, and this seems like, to me, the best thing they've had to actually put games out on in a very long time, including even something like my beloved 3DS. So, I like that, and I think, at least in terms of a lot of the games we saw on stage, I very much liked, and I recognize, okay, we're not seeing a lot of actual third-party stuff, and that is probably not ideal. But I'm also at a point where it's like, I so don't need another console to play third-party games. And I get that there is obviously a business acumen to actually make a console that could compete in that exact way with the PS4 and Xbox One. I can also see the logic in Nintendo doubling down on what they do well and saying, we're launching mid-generation. We're not competing with these other consoles in terms of power because the idea we have here, you just could never do that on in this little tablet. And if we can make something where we can make the best version of what Nintendo does with this, then that's a good thing. And so I saw a lot of that. I feel like Breath of the Wild continues to look absolutely incredible. And I know it is technically also coming out on the Wii U, but also a lot of the indications we got from the show floor are that it's running at a much higher, you know, rate on the Switch. That's what they were saying.
All the reports I've seen is that, like, it still has a rocky frame rate from the demo they played live at the Switch demo they played at E3. So, like, who knows how old the code is. But, like, I even saw the one of the people from GameSpot that played it live, or, like, played it on the show floor. They said that they felt that the E3 demo for the Wii U version ran slightly better, which, who knows, like,
okay, we're
when you're playing that in
then.
Scenarios. But, like, I mean, there has been a lot of weird information of some people saying that Zelda's going to play at 60 frames per second, which, like, I really don't believe that. And some people are saying that it's, like, it'll be 1080p when it's docked. Some people are saying it'll be 900p when it's docked. So there's it's hard to say, like, how that's going to be, but I would bet that those two versions of that game are not substantially different because the Switch is not substantially more powerful than the Wii U. Like, it just isn't. So, like, I would, like, that's one of the reasons why, like, if you own a Wii U, I find it insane, the idea of buying this console at launch, because, like, the one game you want to play is on a console you already own, and it is not like a, like, old-gen version of that game. It is probably, as far as, like, the information we have to go on, effectively the same version.
Okay.
Unless, like, you really want to play it on the go. Like, that is, like, the one thing.
Or, you know, I would want to switch for the future anyway, and why not start now? Anyway,
because who knows what hardware issues they would have. Like, there's lots of reasons not to buy something at launch if there's not, like, a really compelling reason to get it.
Nintendo typically doesn't have those issues.
Nintendo has never made a console like this. So it's like, there are a lot of, like, mechanical, physical parts of, like, snapping things in that's, like, I would be... Unless there was a really compelling reason to get this thing immediately, I would be very, like, want to wait in here, like, a couple months in. Are these things falling apart? Like, you know, like, consoles break, and, like, technology have issues, mechanical parts have issues. Like, that's all I'm saying.
Okay. Anyway, so some of the other games. I mean, I thought the trailer for Super Mario Odyssey was spectacular, and I cannot wait for that thing. I thought a lot of the other games they showed were clearly, you know, looking very, very good on this thing, at least in what we saw, and a lot of games running at 60 frames per second. And things like that, which is something that Nintendo has been able to keep up throughout the Wii and Wii U generations, and I like that. I think there's something to be said about their simpler graphical style being more technically versatile, and I liked seeing a little more of that. I thought they had a good run in the middle of the show seeing some of the different JRPG things, and yes, absolutely, those were not. This game is coming out April 15th or something, and we're going to see it now. But so sad to see it. So I don't know. I mean, again, fundamentally different perspectives on these things.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of things that I thought looked fun and I was very excited for. And just that's where the new awesome Nintendo games are going to be. And it is the system itself is something I am very excited for with. I think it's a very slick piece of hardware. I like the whole idea of the dock and the tablet and pulling it in and out and things like that and going from your TV to the portable. I think the Joy-Cons are a really cool idea. And maybe they could have stripped out some of the extraneous stuff and gotten the price down. But kind of putting that aside for a second, I just, on an island, I like those that idea. I like that it's a versatile kind of control scheme that can work. You know, just you get that in the package and it will work with the thing in your hands, or you can put it into the little dock they have, and you can use it as a normal controller, or just hold them separately, and it's versatile like that. That's something I've noted, I think Jason Schreier at Kotaku was talking about this, that's something he was saying, and I agree with this, like, I really liked doing with the Wiimote and Nunchuck, is not having to hold it like a traditional controller, and you can kind of have the two halves of it separate, and you can do that again with this. So there's things like that. You know, I am disappointed that the price of the Pro Controller is as high as it is, but on the flip side, I also thought that I was definitely going to want one of those at launch, and after I saw both the versatility of what the Joy-Cons can be used for, and then heard from the show floor, people I trust at least, I only listen to a select number of people, I guess, saying that they really liked how the Joy-Cons felt, and they didn't feel like compromised controllers for their size, that I was like, well, maybe I'll get a pro controller at one point, but I don't feel like I need one at launch. So, you know, it is interesting that they don't, I don't know, it's hard to say should they pack one in or not. I don't know with this kind of console what you should or
shouldn't. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that they should have packed it in, but like it should at least be price competitive with the DualShock 4 and the Xbox One controller. Like,
yeah, that's silly. Yeah, that's the $70, not that it's, you know, crazy out of the ballpark. It's not the Xbox Elite controller.
Yeah.
But that $10 does, it just raises your eyebrow of like, that's weird.
Yeah, like it's more expensive enough that you're like, why? Like, I know it has like an Amiibo, like NFC chip reader thing in it, and it has a gyroscope in it. Like, so, like, presumably that's why it's $70, but still, like,
I don't know.
Fuck off, dude. Come on.
I think if you can produce an Xbox or PS4 controller for $60, you can do that for, you know, who knows. I don't know if that's an international price conversion thing they're thinking about. I don't know. Nintendo operates in a different way. And
I mean, that's the whole other thing, is that, like, apparently if you are someone who lives in the UK and other parts of Europe, a lot of that stuff is even more expensive, relatively. I mean, the UK for obvious reasons, and that's what I'm saying, like, for all that stuff being on the priciest side it could be, is that it's like, that's just damaging for the console overall, and when you're coming off of Nintendo that just had a console that, like, in its sales-wise is effectively a failure and has, like, a relatively small number of games on it that, like, are, like, the games that really are attracting people, like, I am very wary of, like, jumping into another Nintendo console from the get-go, and so it's like, you need to do stuff to convince me to get this thing. It's not like an assumption. And so that's like where, like, that $300 price point, it's just on the high enough side that it's like the price point isn't low enough that it's like that's a compelling reason to get it, because you feel like you're getting it cheaper than you really should be getting it, you know?
Yeah. No, I get it. You know, and again, the different perspectives things, you know, where I come at it with this kind of thing is that, you know, even on Nintendo's most disappointing system ever, which is the Wii U, I've reliably had one or two of my favorite games every year wind up on that thing and exclusive to that thing, and there's no reason to think that batting average is somehow going to go down with the Switch. I really do think it would go up if they're merging the two sides of their company to make those. And that is one thing I guess I wish I would have seen a little more of. And maybe some of this just stuff just isn't ready for prime time. And, you know, they do have at least two pretty prominent fucking games coming out for this thing this year. But I would like to have seen more of stuff that we would have, like, traditionally thought of as being on the handheld team for this. And it's tough to say what to do with that, because you've got stuff like, okay, HAL Laboratories just finished a Kirby game that came out last year. They obviously wouldn't have something ready to show for this. Intelligent Systems, Fire Emblem IF came out last year. They're not going to have a new... They have that Fire Emblem Warriors game. They're not going to have...
They're not making Fire Emblem Warriors like Koei Tecmo is making Fire Emblem.
But I'm saying whatever... You know what I mean. Yeah. The next Fire Emblem game, whatever it is not ready for primetime yet. They might not have even started on it because they just finished a massive game. So there's a lot of things like that where because the 3DS was active, is still active up to this point, and they didn't pull the plug on it, which is smart on one level, and then you're like, well, but did they need to re-divert those? I don't know. And so I feel like those people probably are being diverted to work on Switch things. We just don't know, and I don't know if the answer was more people on stage just talking in the abstract. Probably not.
Yeah.
But it's a weird thing where I would have liked to have seen some indication of that, like, this would have been gimmicky on some level, but there's that rumor that I think is pretty well substantiated that there's going to be that Pokemon Stars version for the Nintendo Switch. Even something as small as that, I think, would have been good to see, just in like, okay, they're putting fucking Pokemon on the Switch, and that seems like that's where the future of that series is. That would be very interesting to see.
Yeah, because that is one of the things I'm talking about with the game stuff, of like, one of the things that's really compelling about the idea of the Switch is this dream of like, oh, all of the development arms that Nintendo has focusing all of their energy on just making Switch games, and it's like, and then you announce your console and like your like year lineup, basically. Like, maybe they'll announce some other stuff that's coming out 2017 at E3, who knows. But like, when you come out with that and like there is no sign of anything that feels like, oh, this is like the people who have been making 3DS games are now making like Nintendo console games, like this is awesome. There was not a single one of those. It's like, you needed at least one, because it's like, I looked at this as like the only games they had that interested me at all were Zelda and Mario, and it's like, I can say that about literally every like fucking Nintendo console ever. It's like, all you fucking have is Zelda and Mario, other than like your handhelds is where all the cool weird stuff keeps on coming out. It's like, I want to see that on your main console, and like, there's just enough of a question mark of like, well, if the Switch doesn't sell that well, are those people going to adjust to making Switch, or are they going to keep making 3DS games? Because it's, you know, Reggie and like a bunch of the other executives at Nintendo have said for a while now of like, oh, you know, the Switch is not replacing the 3DS. They live side by side, but it's hard to tell how much of that is just like, well, that's just because the 3DS is, there's still games coming out and you're still selling it, so of course you're going to say that. Whereas like the Wii U's like dead in the water. There's like, or to how much of it is like, no, like legitimately, like this thing is still successful enough that like it is worth it to us to have some of these people still making games on this and like pushing it that way. And it's like, that's one of those places of like, you need to give me something that gives me some amount of confidence that, like, this Switch is going to have all of those games coming out on it. It's like, if I do buy a Switch, like, that is where I will go for the next Fire Emblem game and the next Pokemon game and, like, the next Animal Crossing and the next the fucking Rhythm Heaven or and WarioWare, like, all the shit that they have been making on mobile or on handhelds the entire time. You need some sign of that instead of putting out, like, videos for, like, the two games that are your traditional console-focused franchises, you know? Of, like, the games that, of course, these are going to be on the Switch. That's not... Because, like, I mean, we already knew that Mario game existed in the first place. Like, that's not a surprise in any way. Like, it's cool to see more of it, but, like, I really needed more on the game side to convince me, you know?
I understand. This definitely... If I were to compare this to any other Nintendo launch in terms of what this reminds me of, it's the Nintendo DS. Which is the Nintendo DS came out of this very weird space where at first they were not sure if it was going to replace the Game Boy Advance. Yeah. It had a Game Boy Advance in it. Game Boy Advance development continued for a year or two into its lifespan. And if you asked them, you know, they would very much hedge their bets the same way and say, oh, this isn't necessarily replacing the Game Boy Advance, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately it was like, okay, the DS worked. This is better. We're moving over. And that wound up killing the Game Boy. I would imagine that's what they're doing with this, which is that you've got to be able to pull the ripcord in case it's going to sink your entire company and you don't want to put all your chips in that one basket necessarily. But yeah, I agree. The messaging could be better. Like, I don't necessarily blame them for wanting to hedge their bets behind the scenes and just feel this out because it's such a new space. Anyone would do that. But I do agree just in terms of the messaging of seeing a little more of the kind of unified front that you'd want to see out of the Switch. You could have seen that. At the same time... you know, while 1-2 Switch looked lame to me, and ARMS looks interesting, but I'd like to see more of it, I did like seeing that they've got some of their sort of experimental things going on with it, even though one of those games clearly is a pack-in that they're selling separately.
Yes,
yeah. And 1-2 Switch, to spoil. And it's just, so I like seeing that some of that continuing. The Mario showing was incredible. Zelda showing all of that, of course. And, you know, I liked some of the other things we saw. Again, it's a different thing where I'm looking for a different set of things from this than you are, and there's nothing wrong with that. I get that, but
I mean, because it is. I think we should focus in on like the games that they did show.
Okay,
we've been kind of talking around them. So let's talk about 1-2 Switch, which is like the first game they really led with, because that is like they started doing all the stuff about the controller, and then they led into 1-2 Switch, and then like doing their whole thing, and it is so insane to me that this game is not a pack-in. That's like one of those places where not only is it not a pack-in, it's been sold separately for $50. And it's basically a collection of mini games that I don't think they've said how many games are going to be in it, but it's not like mini games in like a Mario Party or Wii Sports kind of way, but in a like party game of you like one of them I saw is like it uses the sensor on the bottom of the Joy-Con to detect like if you're like opening and closing your mouth, or presumably you could probably just wave your hand back and forth in front of it, and that like will like you're eating a sandwich, and how quickly you're doing that is like you're eating more sandwiches. And there's a lot of stuff that's like using the audio to be like, try to play table tennis using the gyroscope and the accelerometer in the Joy-Con, but instead of, like, you seeing table tennis in, like, a Wii Sports way on the TV, you're going by the audio of, like, trying to react that way. And it's, like, a lot of stuff like that that looks like that might be kind of fun the first time you do it, as like with like a bunch of friends or if your family, sort of showing off what the Joy-Con can technically do, but not something you're going to like come back to multiple times, which is the exact fucking game you want as your pack-in.
It does. It is in that very weird, unique space of a game that no one would bash an eyelash at. If it were a pack-in, you'd be like, of course, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
And when it's not, you're like, what is the purpose of this?
Yeah. Like, imagine if when the PlayStation 4 launched, the Playroom thing, which was their, like, PlayStation camera software stuff that was like, oh, here's, like, a robot, and it shows, like, all
it's
the...
It's where people show their dicks, right?
Yes, basically. Like, when you were live streaming it, you showed your dick, and then, yeah, then Twitch stopped showing non-video game stuff because we're assholes. Not Twitch's assholes. We, the human species, are assholes. I want to be specific about that.
And people were showing their assholes, too.
And people were showing their assholes, too, which there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, don't do that on
there's
Twitch
kind of
with your PS4 camera. Hey, people have been showing people assholes for millions of years.
I meant in that context.
Yeah. Anyway. But like that Playroom software, which is just like, you're like, hey, there's goofy stuff that the PlayStation camera can do. Like, this is like if they sold that separately for $50. You're like, who is going to buy this? Like, it would be, it's a cool, fun add-on if it just comes with the console and you boot it up and say, like, oh, here's how the funny stuff this works. And then, like, maybe, like, a couple months later, you load it up again when, like, a new friend is over at your house. You're like, oh, hey, I'll show you the Switch. Oh, what should we do? Oh, I'll show you this thing first to sort of, like, acclimate you to the concept. And, like, that is a thing that Wii Sports was so brilliant because it is exactly that game of, like, people would not have gone out to go buy Wii Sports, particularly, you know, like the people, the early adopters that go and are getting like Twilight Princess. They're not going to pick up Wii Sports and Twilight Princess. But if it comes with Wii Sports, you bring it home and you show your mom and like your grandma and your brother. It's like, hey, like check out this. Like we can play bowling with these controllers. And that so sold the concept of those controllers and what they did well and what the console did well that it was like, it became a complete sensation. It's like, I certainly don't think like what they showed of 1-2 Switch did not look anywhere near Wii Sports level in terms of like good game design and stuff like that.
Right.
But it at least would have been something. And the idea of selling it separately is just so insane to me.
It's insane. And I mean, now we're talking about it, frankly, the smart thing to do would make Switch Sports. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Like and do that.
Wii Sports 2, but with the Switch.
Which I would like because I really liked the Wii Sports games. And if
yeah.
they wanted to come back to that and do something new with it, that'd be cool. And I think this would actually be, like, that is one thing I'm interested in is, because the Joy-Cons and the general controller setup is versatile enough that you can kind of make any kind of game for this thing if you want, will we see more of that kind of thing? Or, you know, and I guess that's part of the issue with this conference is that you're not quite sure where they're pushing it.
Yeah.
Because really, the ideal launch game for this thing is Zelda Breath of the Wild, because it is this big, significant title that you don't usually get at launch for anything
yeah.
these days. And it's the kind of game you can tell people would want to play at home, away, wherever. Skyrim is the same kind of thing having on there, which isn't... I don't know why that's not coming out till fall. That's another one that's weird to me. And
yeah.
maybe that's a Bethesda thing. I don't know, but...
We'll get to that.
Yeah, so there's just... Yeah, I agree. And so they showed 1-2 Switch.
Then ARMS. Let's talk about ARMS, which is also... This blew my mind when I saw this price point. It's a full $60 game. It so looked like a $20 downloadable title
yeah.
or something like that, which there are a couple, like that Snipper Clippers game or whatever, which I haven't seen a lot of video of, but I've heard
right.
like positive reception
yeah.
to. Like, that's a $20 downloadable title.
But what was Bomberman R? Is that a...
Super Bomberman R is a full $60 game, I believe.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, I have, like, the Nintendo site on, like, on my phone because
okay.
I was looking at this stuff earlier so I can check real quick for Bomberman... Super Bomberman. Oh, they do not have a price listed, although it does say releases March 3rd, 2017, so I don't know why Nintendo does not have a price for that on their website.
That's weird, because that's definitely a launch game.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it says it's a launch game. I've heard the price was $60. I might be misremembering that, but I'm pretty
yeah.
sure it's a full price game. But yeah, but ARMS is the other game they've shown that is using the technology inside of the Joy-Con to do something, and I've heard very mixed things about from people who have been at the events and actually played it. Like, some people seem to like it okay, some people really didn't like it that much. But it seemed like a really simplistic sort of like one-on-1v1 competitive game that you're like sort of fake boxing, although it sounded like you have to like... It's not like Wii boxing where it was just like, you know, you're just sort of like flailing. It's a little bit more like specific, which sounds cool because it sounds a little bit more tactical. It also sounds like a little less cool because it's not... You're not trying to emulate actual boxing or anything like that. Like, you're making very mechanical kind of punching. All was like, it, like the way it was described to me on a podcast I listened to was like almost like Rock'em Sock'em Robot style, which is like
that's what it looked like.
Which is not how you want to do that thing. You want to like bob and weave. And like, I played arcade games before that have had like motion sense boxing controls, and those games were fun because you're sort of like emulating those movements. And like, arms sounded really fun when the guy was talking about it on stage, because that is something about this whole presentation that like a lot of the in-between bits were sort of corny and didn't do a lot for me, but a lot of the actual like Japanese developers on stage talking about their games was really endearing. Yes. And like, and that's one of the places where the translators maybe didn't like convey that super well, which is not a big deal, but it was something where I wish I had loaded up a like Japanese version of the stream or something to hear that directly. But like, the guy did, like, talking about arms sounded really fun and passionate, and he had this whole bit where he did like nobiru, which is like to extend your arm, and he was just like drag that word out really long. And like,
yeah,
I liked him on stage, but when they were like actually showing the game and when I heard about people playing it, like, it doesn't sound that good.
It seemed like the kind of thing, again, that if you had it as a pack-in, would sort of be a slam dunk.
Yeah,
like,
if it was part of a Wii Sports and that was your version of, like, Wii or, like, Switch boxing instead. Yeah. Like, yeah, it sounds like that would have been really awesome.
And who knows, it's not, it's launch window, but it's not day one.
Yeah.
And there could be way more to it than what we saw. Don't want to prejudge it too much. But yeah, based on first impressions, I wouldn't go pay $60 for it. It's not an incentive for me to buy the console, necessarily.
Yeah.
You know. And, you know, some of that falls into just the general thing of what you see with launch hardware and some of the games that come with it. So, yeah.
But that's one of those places of where it just felt like, oh, if you didn't, like, if you didn't have all these, like, gimmicks in your controllers and, like, instead had, like, these people off making, like, proper video games. And, like, I hate to say that, but, like, at some point, it's like, we have so been down this road for over a decade at this point that's, like, come on, like, just, like, have that, like, because, although, actually, should point out, like, arms can be totally played with a normal controller.
Yeah.
It does not need any of the motion stuff at all, which is, like, is part of, like, the point of, like, well, then why even have the motion thing if, like, you do, yeah. If it's not necessary to how you play the game. But, yeah, so that's arms.
I think Super Mario Odyssey was next.
Yeah, let's save Mario and Zelda for the end, because obviously those are the big ones okay. to talk about. I guess they showed a like teaser video for a like unannounced or untitled Shin Megami Tensei game that was like, it was basically just like a camera walkthrough of yeah. a like destroyed hallway and a couple of like the
I
demons.
Really liked it as a teaser.
Yes, it was a cool teaser, but then it was like when it ended with like not even having a title, that was when you realized like, oh, this is so far off in the future. It's kind of like, you know, they basically announced Shin Megami Tensei X Fire Emblem with the announcement of the Wii U, and then that actual game that is materialized did not come out until literally the last year of the Wii U's life, and that kind of feels like this is like, oh, that's so far off in the future.
We'll see. I mean, I would guess that's just Shin Megami Tensei 5, because that's...
But if it was just SMT 5, wouldn't they have just called it SMT 5?
I don't know. We're getting to it. This is a thing that a lot of developers are doing, both Japanese and American, of being coy with your just putting a preview with no title on it. I don't know why that's a thing, but that is becoming a thing in a weird way.
But it was like, it was just straight like up, like, in Japanese text, though, it was just like, it basically said, like, the new project of Shin Megami Tensei.
It reminded me of the initial Halo 5 tease, which was just called Halo. And they did that.
Sure, yeah.
And they were really coy for like a year. That's not necessarily Halo 5.
Right, I remember that. I suspect that was like them wondering whether or not they should go with another naming convention. Because remember, they did put Halo 5 Guardians at the end. So I suspect that was a real, yeah. like, internally, there was some producer who was like, no, it's a new console, like, we need to get, like, new fresh blood in. And people were like, shut the fuck up, it's the fifth Halo game, we're calling it Halo 5. It's like, no, it should be Halo Guardians, no, man.
Let's be honest, that guy was saying it should be called Halo 1.
Yes.
That's what that guy was saying.
You're right, that is what that guy was saying. He was saying it should be Halo 1.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I'm just... If nothing else, I liked that and the little Atlas portion, just because Atlas has had a pretty cool partnership with the 3DS.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing where we actually saw a transfer from 3DS to Switch.
But the thing is, I have no idea if that's a Switch exclusive game or not. Like, okay. Who knows? Because that was like, there was so little information about that game. It was just a small teaser.
Yeah, that's true. They apparently, I did see this on a subreddit, the actual website for Shin Megami Tensei, there's a splash page for that. And it says they're making some 3DS thing, but that one we saw it only says Nintendo Switch beneath.
Okay.
For that, so not iron confirmation.
Who knows? Because again, like, that game is so far off like in the abstract future. But yeah, like,
but I just like that Atlas. I like seeing them there because that's been kind of a... I don't actually have a lot of Atlas games for my 3DS, though I like the ones I have. But they, like, frequently have sales, and they have a shit ton of games on the 3DS. Yeah. And if that continues, that would be, I think, a very good space for Atlas to produce games. So
yeah, I mean, Atlas is a very prolific publisher. Like, they push the shit out on everything. So yeah, there's that. There was...
Fire Emblem Warriors was...
Yeah, Fire Emblem Musou. It's like Musou is like what basically... the Warriors franchise, which is weird that like now I have seen the light of Musou of Dynasty Warriors, and I'm someone who like I really liked the two Fire Emblem games I played back in the day on the Game Boy Advance, but then I saw that and I was like, eh, no, there's no Lubu in this. Like, who gives it? Like, Marth is okay. Marth is not fucking Lubu. Like, who gives a shit if it's a Musou game, if it's not Romance of the Three Kingdoms? Like, oh great, yeah, it's based off of, like, this, like, classic, like, great series of tactical RPGs. I'm gonna play the one that's based off of, like, this brilliant work of, like, foundational literature of, like, Chinese history and culture. Motherfuckers. I'm playing real Musou over here. Who needs this Fire Emblem shit?
I was happy to see a Fire Emblem thing on stage, so I don't know.
Yeah, I thought it was just sort of like funny that at first you're like, oh my god, is this going to be the new Fire Emblem game? And then it comes up as Musou, and you're like, you got me again, you fuckers. Like, it's like you did this with like Zelda back in the day, now you're doing it with Fire Emblem.
It could be cool. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I'm enjoying my time with Dynasty Warriors 8 Extreme Legends, but.
Yeah, and yeah. So, yeah. As a Fire Emblem fan, I just liked the shout out on stage. Yeah. You know, it was cool.
Yeah, there's that. There was Project Octopath Traveler? That's the name of
yes,
that game?
Yes, Project Octopath Traveler, which is the best collection of words ever put
and,
into a video.
And I love that was the one trailer they showed that was narrated by an English speaker. It was not the guy, like, translating over the Japanese. It was straight up, it was just English with Japanese subtitles at the bottom of the trailer translating what's going on. It was like, this is the fucking game that gets the English language trailer, and it ends with this, like, guy who, you know, after he said this, just went, like, what am I doing with my life? It's like, Project Octopath Traveler. It's like, oh, God, I need to talk to my agent. What am I signing my life up for? But that thing, as we know almost nothing about it, but it looked really cool. It was like diorama Final Fantasy, like old school SNES Final Fantasy looking stuff. I liked the way it looked a lot.
I loved it. Yeah, that was a good trailer.
Yeah.
And Square Enix, I don't know if they showed any other trailers. They had a couple other games in the lineup. I know I Am Setsuna is getting a port.
Yeah.
At launch, maybe not launch date, but in the
it's launch window. I can bring up. It's on their.
I think it's March is what they said for I Am Setsuna. Yes. But there's some stuff like that, and that'll be the first other console it's come to, because it's only on PS4 and PC. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so some things like that. Dragon Quest 10 and 11 were in there. It was a brief shout-out,
yeah,
but they were in
like,
there.
Which I'm obviously, like, Dragon Quest has never been that popular over here, and I just have never been into that franchise, although I really like that demo of Dragon Quest Builders. So maybe I am into Dragon Quest. Who knows?
Well, they just put out the 3DS ports over here in America of 7 and 8, and I'd love to try those sometime.
But, yeah, what I was going to say is, like, I have no idea if those are new games, or, like, if they're old, like, how old those are, because it's, like, I just don't know.
I believe 11 is the new one in development, and I think 10 is fairly recent, but has not come to the U.S. at all, if I'm not mistaken.
Because they announced those, and they also announced Dragon Quest Heroes, which is Dragon Quest Musou 1 and 2. Those are also coming to I think 2 is a new one. They definitely already made one Dragon Quest Heroes game.
Yeah, that's on PS4.
Yeah, so those are coming to Switch also. So they did that. Which is like, you know, of course, you know, fucking Dragon Quest has been Nintendo for a long time now. They jumped the Sony ship back in, like, the PS2 days. And then it was like, I think that's when we move on to Bethesda, which was, we had a video of Todd Howard of Bethesda fame saying Skyrim is going to be on the Nintendo Switch to everyone's shock and alarm. Who would have anticipated? What piece of evidence could they have possibly laid in our path before this that Elder Scrolls V Skyrim could possibly come to the Switch? But yeah, like, Skyrim's coming out on the Switch. It seems like I'm going to be interested to hear, like, it's clearly it's not the special edition version because it's not going to be able to be handled, like, the sort of the graphical updates of that. But, like, I'm curious to hear, like, I assume it's going to come with, like, all the DLC and that stuff.
Oh, it's
or, like,
to, yeah.
But I also, like, there are other sort of, like, not just straight up, like, technical improvements, but, like, engine changes and stuff they did when they did special edition. I'm very curious to hear if it's more that version of the game. So it's and not,
because
like
it looked very much like the special edition.
It's definitely not the special edition, okay. No. Like, I'm just like, it's one thing, I'm very curious for when that version of the game comes out, which, like you said, it's coming out fall 2017, it's not a launch game. I'm just curious to see, like, if it's going to be, like, a good version of that game or not, because I think there's a very good chance that it's, like, Skyrim is a buggy game, regardless. Like, the special edition version they came out with fixed some of the bugs, introduced new bugs. I'm just worried that maybe that version of the game is not going to be that good when you think about, like, when the Wii U launched and it had a bunch of Western third-party games on it that did not do very well in terms of, like, the technical department.
And it's also true that, as you say, because of the special nature of Bethesda games, that's not going to be the best test case either for how AAA games will run on the Switch.
Yeah, which I'm not saying that as, like the Switch is not capable of running Skyrim. I'm saying that, like, I'm just worried that... Although, it does seem like Bethesda is handling it in-house as far as, like, all the indications go, though, like...
Yeah.
They would not tell us probably immediately if another studio was handling that port, but...
They seem pretty confident in it just in terms of its marketing presence in the Switch lineup.
Yeah, but, like, I think it is enough of a, like, question mark to be, like, until we have, like, hands-on reports from people who have actually played that version of that game, I'm very curious to hear how that thing's going to turn out. Because again, like, there were... Because other than Skyrim, there was one other Western developer... represented on stage, and that was EA. They brought out Soccer Man from EA, who stood up there.
Really creepy.
He was very creepy. He was like, and there was something. This is like a really weird personal thing, but there's something about hearing they had like an American guy who was translating what the guy was saying into Japanese. And obviously, like whenever you have someone Western who like learned Japanese saying Japanese, like there's a very specific accent, and there's something that like I have such an associated response to hearing that from taking Japanese classes. I have like a weird, almost like nervous response to hearing that dude talk in Japanese. It's really difficult to quantify, and it's just like I haven't heard that in like a year now or so. It's like I don't hear a lot of people fucking like I don't hear a lot of Americans speaking Japanese in my life all the time anymore. I had this weird fucking response to that. That's like neither here nor there. But that guy was talking about they're going to have FIFA, I guess it'd be FIFA 18, is going to come to the Nintendo Switch. And I have heard competing reports, and I don't know if, like, how much of this is people speculating or not. It's, like, there's an element of a lot of this launch stuff of, like, there's some things that are, like, really hard to sort of get concrete information on that's kind of frustrating. Of whether or not FIFA 18 on the Nintendo Switch is going to be the same fundamental game as FIFA 18 on the PS4 and the Xbox One. Or if they're going to do what sports games have done for years and years and years now, like decades now, really, which is have the Legacy Edition, which is the edition that is on the old console that does not have, like, the gameplay improvements and stuff, but is just, like, whatever the last version of FIFA was for, like, the PS3 or whatever, or the 360 or the Wii U, and just, like, update the roster instead of updating all the gameplay elements. I have not heard specifically one way or the other, but, like, that's one of those things of, like, I'm also curious, like, is EA going to take all of their sports franchises and put it on the Switch at some point? Because, like, they did that for the Wii for a long time, and then I felt like they did that for the launch of the Wii U, more or less. And then, like, I don't think they put more of those out on the Wii U, really. Maybe they probably put FIFA, because FIFA has such a worldwide appeal.
But everyone ditched the Wii U so fast, because it kind of arrived. It was dead on arrival in terms of sales. So it'll be, I mean, a lot of that is going to be how well the Switch sells out of the gate, you know.
But it is like, it was not a strong, like, show of confidence by any Western developer of, like, Bethesda going up there and saying, we're putting our 5-year-old game out on this, which is like, you know, hey, Skyrim is, in my opinion, the best game they've made. I would like Skyrim to be the game they put out, but it's like, it is interesting that they're just putting, like, it's not Skyrim and Fallout 4 or just Fallout 4 or something. It is Skyrim that they're putting out on it, and then EA's up there, and like all they talked about was FIFA, and fucking Ubisoft wasn't even on that stage, and Ubisoft was like, Ubisoft will show up to, if you put out a fucking video game console, Ubisoft will come up on your stage and they will just, they'll put something out, they'll put some Raving Rabbids bullshit, they'll put something on your console. Like, they have supported everything. They supported like the Wii U for way longer than anyone else. Like, they put fucking Zombie U out on that thing, and there are some Ubisoft games coming out. There's, in a really hilarious sort of twist of fate, Rayman Legends, the 4-year-old Rayman game that was originally going to be a Wii U launch exclusive, that then got delayed, that then got delayed, that then got delayed, and then came out on everything else, and then came out on the Wii U, is going to come out at some point on the Nintendo Switch. I believe Steep, their extreme sports game that just came out in like October on the PS4 and the Xbox One, they have said that that's going to come out on the Switch, although I am suspect of that because it did not perform sales-wise very well on the PS4 and Xbox One, so I bet they're going to just shuttle that version of that game.
It's hard to know with Ubisoft because they don't have anything super high profile at the moment. Like, because when the Wii U came out, they were able to say things like Watch Dogs coming
forward. Yeah, like Assassin's Creed 3 was at the launch version right. of
But there was Wii U. No Assassin's Creed this year, and Watch Dogs 2 no one gave a shit about. So it's...
And Watch Dogs 2 already came out, and like, they're not going to put that on the Switch.
There's no upside for anyone on that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's some weird things. Like, I feel like if they had an Assassin's Creed announced on the horizon, that might have been what we would have seen, but who knows? It might not have been able to handle that either.
Yeah, the Switch is in a weird situation because the Wii U could, for a little bit, kind of hang on with like Watch Dogs and stuff. Although I don't even know if that Wii version of Watch Dogs ever even really came out.
It did come out.
Okay,
it did not. It wasn't good.
Yeah, I wouldn't suspect so. But like the only reason why that happened is because that was like close enough at like the bridging that like people were still putting out old versions of games on old consoles for a couple of years, for like the right. Xbox 360 and the PS3, that's not happening anymore. So I don't think like porting something to the Nintendo Switch that is made to be played on the PS4 and the Xbox One and the PC is like, even in terms of, I think, like the actual like technology of the hardware, in terms of the style of hardware it is, as far as my understanding of it, is that it's actually easier than the Wii U. But in terms of the power of that hardware, it's like that gap is just as wide as it has ever been, and there's no reason to try to bridge that gap anymore other than just the Switch. And so, like, I don't think you're going to really see ports of those games. But, like, even regardless of that, I just don't think you're going to really see many, based on what they showed here, I don't think you're going to see many Western developers support any sort of Switch game at all, like, port exclusive otherwise.
Yeah, and I guess this is something that I don't think that inherently has to be an end-all problem. I think there are things that the Switch will and can be very good for that they could push, and I think I wish there would have been a little segment on this, which is stuff like indie games or things like that.
Sure,
that will
yeah.
not rely on the power of the system to that kind of degree. And, you know, something like, I'm not saying like they had to do this game exactly because it's been out for a year, but like an IM Setsuna, something like that to show, you know, these games that, you know, big developers are starting to have, those studios that make the smaller things, and showing that that can be on there, those kind of games of the world. And they did actually have a big sizzle reel of third-party games. There were a couple of those kind of things in there that I thought should have been pulled out and talked about more.
Yeah, I mean, that is the kind of stuff that, like, you know, if you had, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but, like, some, like, new indie game that is in development that is on the horizon of, like, I mean, then they did have Has-Been Heroes, which is by Frozen Byte, that they made Trine 1, 2, and 3, though we don't talk about Trine 3 because nobody liked that game. But, like, they are making that Has-Been Heroes game that I think is also coming on PC. That's another place where it's, like, really hard to get, like, solid information on everything yeah. about that game. But, like, that is in development for the Switch. It was playable at the Switch events in New York and London, but they didn't talk about that at all on the stage. And it's, like, you needed something for me to be, like, to grasp onto and, like, for you to put this out of, like, the Switch is a home for people that are making indie games. You can bring them here. Like, and maybe it will be. But they need to fucking say that. They need to have, you know, what the Sony's brilliant move they did when they announced their console of just having, like, a dozen indie developers on stage all just playing their game in this, like, big, like, panoramic thing of, like, and we've got, like, the Galaxy over here and, like, this zombie game up here and, like, The Witness and we've got, like, all these games of, like, all these indie developers are coming to our console. And that was such a brilliant power move. And it's like, the Switch doesn't need something that sort of, like, flashy because we know that indie games are here. We know, like, they are big. It's a big market. It's a big thing. But you need something that says, like, these people are going to come and make games on our console, too. Because that a lot of those indie games are, by their nature, smaller. And if they are smaller, they tend to be sort of more simplistic to play, which is the exact kind of game you want on a portable device. It's the one thing that, like, the saving grace of the Vita, after, like, Sony basically abandoned it in terms of, like, them developing games for it, is that every fucking indie developer under the sun wants to put a game out on the Vita because their games are really good portable. And the Vita is a great machine to play, like, fucking Thomas Was Alone or whatever on the go. And you want to just, like, put an hour into that game, like, on a train or something, you can do that. that is such a great market for the Switch to get into. Hopefully the Switch will get into that, but like they needed to put something on the stage. They needed to at least talk about it a little bit, and they didn't talk about it at all, and I thought that was a huge missed opportunity.
It is, you know, Nintendo has a weird thing that I wonder what they're going to do with their marketing in this kind of press conference, because they fundamentally, you know, don't play the same kind of press conference game as everyone else is doing with, like, their Nintendo Direct stuff. And part of that is that they don't have a lot of third-party people on stage a lot. They don't make those... And, you know, a lot of people are clearly developing for the Switch in this first year, but even a lot of that we just didn't see last, you know, this week. So it's weird that, you know, maybe they need to be better at just that outreach kind of thing and getting people on stage and not being as insular. The other thing that's interesting is that I would expect we have not seen the entire lineup for the year 2017. And part of that is just that Nintendo very frequently does not show a game until it's done and they're going to put it out. It's very rare that you get the kind of Breath of the Wild or Zelda thing where they announce it 3 years ahead of time and then keep giving little teases, and that really only happens on their absolute biggest games. Otherwise, you get a lot of games that are often very good on the 3DS and Wii U and things like that that they just announce and then 3 months later it's out. Like this year they had Kirby Planet Robobot and Paper Mario Color Splash and things like that, and those are in development, and but until that is like done and ready to go, they're not going to say a goddamn thing about it, and I'm okay with that, but I also wonder if it's the smartest strategy for a launch if they have some of those things that are probably in development and maybe they're saving for an E3 announcement or something or a summer push or something, but you know, those some of those roadmap marks aren't there yet.
Yeah. So another big game that I just realized we didn't talk about, which is insane we didn't talk about this, because it is like is the biggest Switch exclusive game that is coming out before Mario, which is to say is effectively the only Switch exclusive game that they talked about that's coming out before Mario that is not at the launch, is Splatoon 2.
Oh, right.
They're making a sequel to Splatoon. I have the video indicated to me, and I have heard a lot of impressions that are like, it is very good. It is also like very much more Splatoon, which is like, you know, I've never played Splatoon, so I can't speak to it, but it is the, like, it feels like it. They could have probably just called it like Splatoon Switch Edition with like a bunch of extra weapons.
Well, and
stuff.
Here's the thing. So they've got Splatoon 2 and Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, which weirdly they didn't show on the in the main conference, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, which is a little, not that it had to be the center of everything, it's just that game's going to sell, you know? It's Mario Kart.
Yeah, Mario Kart always sells, like, way more than you would ever think. It sells ungodly amounts of money.
Right, and I think it could be a boon to that system. And so the rumors were all, and what we had heard is that they were doing basically a Splatoon port. Yeah. They decided to call it Splatoon 2. I don't think that's necessarily a bad strategy, because let's back up and remember, and this is also true to talk about with Breath of the Wild as a launch game, most people don't own a Wii U.
Yes,
it will be new to most people, even to some Wii U owners. I'm a Wii U owner who buys most of the major games. I've not played Splatoon. I will probably play Splatoon 2 if I have the chance, because it's supposed to be really good, and that would be the version to play, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it'll be new to me, too. So, yeah, they probably, I think they could have gotten away easy with calling it Splatoon Deluxe or something like that, or Splatoon Switch Edition. They decided to go Splatoon 2. That's interesting. It also makes me wonder what they're doing with Smash Bros., because there's all reports are they're working on something Smash Bros. For the Switch. If it were just a port of the Wii U game, I would expect we would have seen it. We didn't, so who knows? That could also be something they're holding off for the summer as a surprise. That would not shock me in the slightest. So I don't know. What do you think about them calling it Splatoon 2?
I'm fine with it. It's one of those things where it was just felt like, because it was one of those things where there were just so many fucking rumors before the Switch came out. We made fun of that at the top of the podcast. But it was like for a very long time you're hearing all these rumors about like, Splatoon is like, it's an updated version of Splatoon that has like some new weapons and a new map or two that is going to come out on the Switch. And then like, it's the same thing with like Mario Kart 8, and you like saw glimpses of that in that one video they put out. And then it like comes out, it does feel like, I mean, it sounds like the additions of like the new maps and the new weapons to Splatoon 2 sound like it's more substantial than what they added to Mario Kart 8. But it does feel a bit weird of like, why are these two things getting like this like different treatment when they do feel fairly similar in terms of like how they have been updated and changed?
Yeah, and look, it's very smart for them to port those Wii U things over, because very few people own a Wii U, and Mario Kart 8, while being one of the highest selling games for the Wii U and may have one of the historically highest attach rates of any game ever for a non-bundled game, is still like the lowest selling Mario Kart game. So I think it's smart to do that. And, you know, I own Mario Kart 8 and all the DLC. I would happily probably buy that again because it's got the new stuff, and I would happily have it to play on the go and more multiplayer stuff. So, you know, I did think it was a... So Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is coming out April 28th.
Yes, yeah. It's one of like the only games past. I think it might actually be the only game past the release date that has a like firm release date.
Right, and you know, I think it probably makes sense not to put that out day one just to not cannibalize Zelda. But I don't know if a full 2 months later makes sense. Who knows? But yeah. I think it's fine either way.
I mean, because there's like five games coming out of the launch of this console. Like it is, it is.
Well, here's the other thing they didn't talk about.
Yeah,
is virtual console stuff.
Yeah, no.
We know there's going to be something, if for no other reason than their online plans talks about NES and SNES games being on the console. We also just know logically they're going to have a virtual console thing. We've got the reports that are from Eurogamer, so I would say they're very reliable about the GameCube stuff, which could totally be their day one. Who knows? It might be something that they're saving to show off in a couple weeks. I don't know. But they did not talk about virtual console plans, and you would expect in the early days that to be something that helps boost the console.
Yeah.
So that's a little weird that that didn't get touched on.
Yeah, because that is some of that stuff of like what felt weird about the presentation is it didn't feel like it was this strong, holistic representation of the Switch. It was like this weird, because one of the things that they all barely focused on at all in the whole presentation was that you can take this thing on the go. Like, they barely addressed that at all. It was like such a weird thing where it felt like that's the core, that is what is so fucking cool about the idea of your system. Like, show that and market that to me and like get that out there instead of focusing on like the fucking gyroscope and the HD rumble or whatever in your Joy-Con controller. And there's a lot of weird gaps like that of like you're saying with the virtual console or indie games of like, this is probably going to have to be a part of this console. Like, it would be, well, we know the virtual console thing will be an element of the Switch through like weird extraneous information that came after the fact that we need to talk about more of that. But like, have that on stage and be like, here's what the like, look how awesome this is. Like, this is like this like really great looking version of Super Mario World that you can like put up there and it's got its save states. And then when like you're like, oh shit, I need to go get on the bus, you can just grab this and you're still playing Super Mario World. Like, again, fucking. One of my favorite things about the Game Boy Advance was all the great Super Nintendo games that they put on that system because those games are brilliant on the go. Fucking put that in your presentation and like market that to me and make me excited about it.
I definitely don't know how there wasn't a PS4, like a Sony style. Sony is so good at showing those kind of gameplay demos.
Yeah.
And people like on different sides of the stage, or like when Microsoft showed off Forza Horizon 3 and they had the people playing on the PC and the Xbox with the different control setups, there should have been someone on stage with the Switch, like, pulling it out and being like, now I'm playing it here. Like,
I mean, that is such a... They had so many bits that they had of, like, that Splatoon 2 guy was fucking awesome and was so let down by the translators because he was so all over the place and cool and energetic. But they did have... The main presenter was this guy, Koizumi. I don't really know what his role is. It was one of, like, the sad things where you remember Iwata passed away because he so would have been giving this presentation. But he did a very good job, but it does feel like, how do you not cut back to the stage and have this dude just, like, laying on a couch, like, Shuhei Yoshida style, just playing the thing on the TV, and he's like, oh, hey, sorry, like, then goes and, like, grabs it and gets up and keeps on giving his presentation or something. Like, it is, it's so built to have those kinds of gimmick, like, stage moments, and they did some of that kind of stuff, but it does feel like they mixed a trick with that one in particular.
All right, so what else do you want to talk about before we get to Mario and Zelda?
Suda51 was on stage, stressing the hell out of a translator, talking about he wants to make a new No More Heroes game that's like a sequel to No More Heroes on the Switch, but like they haven't started making it yet, and is going to like have some wrestling. It's like, it was so hard to get a sense of what he was talking about. I thought it was one of the most weird sort of meandering things I've seen in a video game press conference since, like, Pele was on the EA stage of, like, why is this segment in here? Like, I get Suda51 is a very popular developer, particularly in Japan. I like the dude. He's got personality. I've not liked a lot of the games he's made that I've tried, but, like, I like him as a developer and his presence and, like, what he brings to the table. It's like, save him for when he has a fucking game, you know? Like, that just, it felt so... Especially because of like this presentation was so thin on actual games being shown and played and like pitched, and like an actual game there being pitched to you, that it felt weird to be like fucking have. I would rather have you be showing Mario Kart 8 Deluxe right now than have Suda51 on stage talking about a game that's not even being made yet. You know.
Actually, now that we talk about it, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe would have been the perfect game to show for a couple of reasons, because it would have worked so well as a demo for on the go with multiplayer. Just take it out and show a bunch of versions of it, because there's a kind of shared knowledge of that game.
Show a person with a tiny little wheel with a Joy-Con in it, because they have one of those fucking Wii things. Is like, I know there are some people that like to play the Mario Kart Wii stuff with the wheel thing. I could not stand playing that game with motion controls. Give me a fucking GameCube controller any day, but I would have loved to see a full grown man on stage with like a little tiny wheel, just like
So what else did you want? So we said Suda 51.
Suda 51. I'm trying to think if they showed any other game stuff on stage or not.
I think we hit it all.
Yeah. I think that's probably it. And I don't think there were any other Has-Been Heroes was one of those that was talked about.
Have a sizzle reel that was pretty dense with cool stuff, like, you know, they're porting Dragon Ball Xenoverse 2, there's Sonic Mania, the new Sonic Generations game, they had I Am Setsuna shown in there, they had a bunch of other third-party things.
Disgaea 5 Complete, Fast RMX, Farming Simulator, Minecraft, Minecraft Story Mode, Puyo Puyo Tetris, which is the first time that game has come to the West, I think.
That actually looks pretty cool, too.
That looks cool. Rhyme, Siberia 3, I don't know what that is. Like, Super Sonic 2017, NBA 2K18, Lego City Undercover, which is like, it took me a long time to remember that that used to be a Wii U exclusive game. That's also will be out on the Switch. I Am Setsuna, and one of their other, one of their five launch games, Skylanders Imaginators.
Right.
So if you want to play Skylanders on the Switch, you
can get some that. Of that is just launch fluff, but some of that is substantial enough that I thought it should have had a bigger presence.
Sure, I mean, a lot of it is like ports of games that, like, some of those, like Rayman Legends, are like 4 years old. Some of them are a couple months old. But yeah, like, some of the, like, if you don't have a lot, at least show what you have instead of trying to show what you don't have, which is like what they were doing with Suda 51, you know?
But frankly, even something like Sonic Mania would kind of be another perfect game to do a demo of.
Yeah, because that game is not out yet, like has not come out on any system, unlike most of the other games, like Disgaea 5 and stuff like that, that has been out on systems for years. Yeah, Sonic Mania has not come out yet, or like Project Sonic 2017, like even if those are multi-platform games,
those would be cool to show.
Yeah, they'd be cool to show because they haven't been on other stages, and fucking Sony and Microsoft do that all the time of showing a third-party game that's like a year or two out, and just like kind of like not really saying, of course this is going to be multi-platform, but we're not going to tell you.
Like I'll say also, like Sonic Mania, it'll be coming out after the Switch launches. That will absolutely be the platform I buy that on.
Sure,
the perfect place to play.
Sounds like it would probably be a really good portable game.
Yeah. So just there's more that I thought they could have pulled out, even if a lot of that is ports or launch fluff or whatever. So there's that. But they had Mario in the middle, and they ended the presentation with Zelda. Which one do you want to hit first? Mario Odyssey.
Sure, Super Mario Odyssey.
It made me so happy. I'm sorry. It just there's other than Persona 5, which I know is just in its class of its own and is a different thing.
Yes,
it's
is.
It's going to be very hard for any other game to make me that excited in 2017. And we've got a lot of good games coming this year. Just, you know how much I love Mario.
Yeah.
The big 3D Mario games are rare, and we haven't. The last one we had was on the Wii U in 2013, and that was a sequel to the 3DS game.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you really can go back to Mario Galaxy 2, which was 2010, so it's kind of been a while. And this one, my tweet about this was that it looks like every Mario game past and somehow future mushed into one and looks fucking crazy. And it looks beautiful and just, I can't wait. That game looks insane in the way that I want a new Mario 3D game to look. And yeah, Mario went full Sonic Adventure at the beginning there.
Yeah, no, like, that's, like, I'm overall, like, was pretty intrigued by what they showed with Super Mario Odyssey. Like, it is, if they're going to make a Mario game, like, the sort of, like, weird, sandboxy, open-level kind of thing that Super Mario 64 and Sunshine to a lesser extent, but still was kind of that game, like, that's what I would want from a Mario game. But there was something about the art style that felt off to me, and it wasn't just like the city stuff. Like, the city stuff is insane and kind of made me feel creeped out in a weird way of like watching Mario, the cartoon Mario Man, walking next to full like normal sized humans. Because at least with Sonic, like Sonic Adventure in the 2006 game and Sonic next to humans, is Sonic isn't a fucking human, he's a cartoon hedgehog. Like, it's in a weird way, it's okay for him to exist with humans because it's like Roger Rabbit or something. Roger, if like, imagine how creepy and fucked up it would be if Roger Rabbit was like Popeye or something, was a cartoon human acting next to live action humans. Like, this is wrong. This is not. They can't both be humans at the same time. And clearly this, like, New York City businesswoman is an actual human.
New Donk City.
So what the fuck is Mario? What has he been the whole time? Has he been lying to us when he's, like, a human plumber man?
I assume it's some kind of dimensional portal.
I mean, that's what basically they said. I think it's basically the Mass Effect Andromeda of Mario games. And yes. That he's gone to a different galaxy. It's all new rules, new species, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, like, the stuff, like, again, like, it's, like, a... Who knows? Because a lot of the stuff of like the broader structure of that game, what they did not show off, and I don't think they needed to show off. Like, that game has a full year of marketing ahead of it if it's going to hit that holiday 2017 date. But it was like there were a couple of moments of Mario walking in like this weird sort of realistic looking dark forest that was like, what the fuck? Like, what?
I liked the art style. I mean, thought it looked
like,
cool, but...
Like, not in a 100% bad way. Like, you know, like, it kind of in a weird, it's good way, and in a weird, it's really fucking weird way. And it kind of, like, changed a lot based on the, like, what areas he was in. And so, okay. Like, who knows, like, in the full game, this is not me, like, presenting, like, a critique or something of that. It was just, like, a weird thing of, like, what the fuck is this game?
Well, and I like that with Mario, because it's like... The best thing about the 2000s Mario's games is that they are at their best when Nintendo just decides this is where we're going to get creative and throw it all together, whether or not there's one unifying aesthetic or not. So, like, the Galaxy games are basically, by the time you get Galaxy 2, it's like a series of different game styles that they're just doing, and Mario 3D Land and World were crazy, and I mean,
that's
the
one of the things
Odyssey
that was
is...
the most disappointing about Super Mario Sunshine is that it's basically all set on that island with that tropical island art style, at least all the parts of that game I got into, which I played like over halfway through that game, and I've got it, and so like it is certainly a plus on for me of like that they showed a bunch of different crazy environments and like Candy Land and Forest and New Donk City, which is like the thing that has been torturing me so much since I saw that, Jonathan. What happens when you jump on the humans?
I want to find out.
What happens when you jump on the humans, Jonathan?
Speaking of jumping, some of the control stuff in that trailer was really cool also, because there's this new thing where he can throw his hat, and there's one moment where you're in the city and he throws his hat and you jumps on it to get over a gap in a building. That kind of just looks like this is going to be a cool controlling game.
Yeah, it looked a lot smoother than like how the flood thing worked in Super Mario Sunshine. Like the him just throwing his hat and it being like this like temporary floating platform thing, that did look really smooth. But then they ended it with showing that the hat is like a sentient creature with eyes, which then again, it begs the question, what the fuck happens when you jump on the hat, Jonathan? Because he's jumping on the hat, and every other thing he jumps onto disappears and dies and, like, obliterates.
Maybe one of the dimensions you go to in this game is the dimension where all the things Mario jumps on get, like, transported to.
It's Mushroom Kingdom Hell, and just, like, they just, like, devour Mario alive.
It's like
it becomes a fucking Greek tragedy where he has to, like, go to hell to save Princess Peach, and then he can't look back, and then he's about to escape, and he finally gives in and looks back, and then Princess Peach gets dragged back to the pits of hell. Is that what you're telling me, Jonathan?
I think that's where we're going.
Okay, because I want to play that game.
I was thinking specifically of, like, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy chapter, where you learn that all the ballpoint pens in the universe that you lose go to the same planet, or there's the mattress planet, or things like that. Yeah, the as Douglas Adams says, the concept of infinity is very powerful.
I really like the look of their pimped out Bowser.
Yeah.
That man has gone places, and it's another step they have gone that, like, with the Mario franchise for me, that at some point I'm just rooting for fucking Bowser because that's a classy looking dude. Like, here you have this scruffy fucking plumber man who wears his dirty plumbing trousers and, like, overalls all over the place, never takes them off. And this is a guy who can dress up. What does Peach see in Mario? Like, Bowser is this go-getter. He's proactive. He dresses well. He's a single father who's raised a son all on his own. He plays all these sports. I think they changed the canon that they're not his children, the ones from Super Mario Bros. 3. But, like, just Bowser is this amazing person. Mario is this fucking plumber that sits on his ass all day, and then every once in a while he goes out and jumps on some fucking mushrooms. Like, one of them seems like a man you want to live with. Another does not. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, my God. Did you read the Kotaku article explaining why Wario is Mario?
Yes, yeah. Off of, like, Super Mario Run's objective being to just amass a ridiculous number of coins. And
do toad apartheid where you separate all the toads by color.
Yeah, it makes sense, you know?
It's one of the best things about Mario is that because they've never narrativized Mario, you can just make up these crazy stories with it, and I love that. I hope we never lose that with Mario.
Yeah, and it definitely seemed like Super Mario Odyssey. And it's not like it feels like they are so cognizant of the fact that people love to come up with weird lore things for Mario because they never say anything about it. In a way that's a lot more fun than people did with Legend of Zelda, of, like, weird timeline shit. Here's just, like, you know, what if, like, Peach and Bowser really love each other? Like, that's a classic one and stuff like that. And Mario just keeps on getting in the way. It's always a fun idea. But I like that it seems like Nintendo's kind of cognizant of it. And it's not just feeding the fire with, like, Pimp Bowser and all this shit. And Mario just going to New Donk City, which is, like... That has to be where Donkey Kong is set, right? Like, the original Donkey Kong, which was, like, that was clearly supposed to be New York City. Are we going to see fucking Pauline, his original girlfriend? Is that going to be a whole... Is there going to be a love triangle subplot? I have to know. Maybe I will get a Switch just to find out, just to know what happens in the narrative of Super Mario Odyssey.
Yeah. No, the reports actually right up until this was announced was that a lot of people thought this was going to be a launch game.
Yeah,
but
it's like very much not like
it's a holiday.
Yeah, it's holiday 2017. It's the farthest out game with like an actual release window that they talked about.
Yeah, and I would imagine that will actually be holiday 2017. Mario games never typically slip on their dates, and if
it does slip, I don't think it would slip by much.
No, and you know it does make sense if they have it relatively ready to go to hold that to be their big holiday game in some way, especially if maybe they have more plans for the summer that we don't know about yet. But yeah, I obviously it would have been dumb to release both Zelda and Mario on day one. That would have just cannibalized each other.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, luckily they have Zelda on day one too. So
let's talk about Zelda then. Yeah.
Putting aside any of that other stuff that it's a cross-platform, all that.
Yeah.
The trailers for this game are unbelievable.
They're really good. Just, yeah.
I mean, and this one. Really into the realm of, like, top three or four video game trailers I've ever seen. They're just... What they can do in these trailers with just pure atmospherics is unlike anything I've ever seen in video game marketing. And then this one particularly just has a minute and a half of mic drops at the end where they're like, right, you've seen nothing of this game.
Right,
and let's just show you a quick reel of all the things that you have not seen and we're probably not going to show you until the game actually comes out. Including... what seems to be fairly prominent use of voice acting that, in Japanese at least, is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And in English, was okay.
I never saw the English trailer.
They did. It's okay. It's,
I wonder who voice acts Zelda.
That's the best voice in the trailer. Yeah. You have heard her because she's the woman who says, you know, Link, wake up. In the demo that they showed at E3.
Okay, yeah.
It's the same voice. But at least in Japanese, those voices were awesome.
Yeah.
So, and I hope there's dual
audio. I really like the line, the history of Hyrule is the history of Calamity Ganon. That is such a good line. And, like, you know, like, Zelda has been a series that, like, sometimes is weirdly story-heavy in the way that Twilight Princess is. Generally is sort of light on the story the way Ocarina of Time was. And then every once in a while, Ocarina of Time would give you, like, a huge exposition dump. But, like, I do really, really like what they have shown and hinted at about the story of this being, like, you know, to get up your ass with fucking Zelda lore, which is something I hate, but here it seems, like, really appropriate, of this being Hyrule, like, way in the future, and there's, like, all this, like, destroyed civilization, like, weird technology stuff and, like, robot-looking things that have, like... It feels like kind of some of the stuff they wanted to do with the story of Twilight Princess, only not fucking terrible. And that, like, is appealing to me because I liked a lot of the pitch of Twilight Princess and I really liked Midna as a character, but all the stuff they did with the Twilight Realm and fucking, like, Wolf Link and all that shit was so bad and just, like, plotted that hopefully, like, here they, like, have, like, nailed it. The one thing, like, I mean, I'm so intensely curious about this game of, like, the larger structure and stuff and, like, the pacing and stuff because it's, like, obviously you have all this open world stuff in it. But I have to say, like, they have intrigued me on the story of this game in a way I would have never expected them to do with a Legend of Zelda game.
It just looks so fucking gorgeous. Every second of it. And, like, when they get into some of the story stuff here, like, everyone's been saying it, but the moment where Zelda, like, bursts into tears and grabs Link, it is viscerally, like, it catches your breath of, like, it is cinematically a powerful moment. And then playing on the arc iconography of that being Zelda and Link is, it's almost hard to put into words how powerful an image that is. And some of the other ones in this trailer. Like, just the reimagining of all these pieces of Zelda lore in this new setting with that level of, you know, like, Studio Ghibli kind of cinematic anime, you know, craziness. The way the music is so minimalistic through all of this, also, it is just gorgeous. Each of those trailers just works as like a little short film, but then this one felt like a short film where they just dropped the fucking mic several times on like, yeah, you've seen the tip of the iceberg of this thing, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm psyched.
Yeah.
I mean, this is easily, I feel like, the most significant launch game in a couple generations.
Yeah, like the one thing I would say that takes away from that is that it is a cross-platform game. Sure, that, like, the other version of it is not a diminished version of that game. So it's like,
maybe, but yeah,
probably not a diminished version of that game.
Yeah.
So like it is, like, I really want to play this game bad. I do not want to play this game $360+ bad. But
it's also, It's cross-platform for a system that very few people have. So I do think, although,
like, I mean, over 10 million people have, and, like, I bet you the vast majority of the people who buy the Switch at launch would be people who own Wii U's, because they are the Nintendo faithful. Like, those are they're almost undoubtedly going to sell out their, like, pre-launch, like, launch orders. Like, that's every console does, basically. And so, like, it is something that, like, I am really curious to see how that affects it, you know?
Yeah.
How that split goes of, like, because also, you know, like, we are in the digital future. You can't underproduce the Wii U version of Legend of Zelda the way they did with the GameCube version of Twilight Princess. So like, I'm curious to see how that's going to affect the dynamics of how that stuff sells.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, it's just I'm so excited for that game. And yeah, I could technically just play it with my Wii U.
You should play it with the Wii U and have the Switch come out and wait to see if there are any problems with it.
But I want to have a Nintendo Switch. I get these things. I also have a podcast where I talk about this stuff. I understand I'm in a different situation. You know, we could think about those recommendations, but, you know, I am excited to have this be the first thing on the new hardware.
Okay. I'm just saying that from a logical, rational point of view, you're making a mistake.
I don't think I'm making a mistake. There's a lot about the Switch. There is
like a good chance that you're not making a mistake. There's also a not insignificant chance that you are making a mistake, and you could easily wait and make that insignificant chance a 0% chance and have a 100% certainty on whether or not the Switch is a console that you want to buy at launch with that's not going to have hardware problems and stuff like that, because the game you're going to play at launch is a game you can play on a system you already own. All I'm saying.
Okay.
It's illogical.
Okay. The best launch games by far for the Xbox One and PS4 were also available on PS3 and 360. So this is not
those were not like the only launch games that anyone wanted to play.
But they were the only ones worth anything. The best launch game on the PS4 was Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag by a country mile.
I mean, that was the best one, but like Resogun was a really good game. Like Killzone Shadowfall was not bad. Like it was a pretty good, and then there was a lot of games that came out relatively shortly after the console that very quickly justified that.
Yeah, I mean, it took a while for the actual train of actual next-gen exclusives and not ports to come.
No, but I mean, yeah, like, certainly The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild is a brilliant game, or it's probably going to be a brilliant game, and it's, like, a great game to buy for a video game system, but, like, yeah.
But I'm just saying, look, there are a lot, especially if you split, I get there's about 10 to 12 million Wii U owners.
Yeah.
Split that out by region, it becomes very marginal per region, and then you say, look, there's going to be a lot of people who missed a Nintendo generation, and I can see that game specifically being a draw-in.
Yeah.
And I think it's not insignificant to note that, in that most consoles don't launch with a game that significant.
Yeah, no, sure.
So, you know, I don't want to minimize it too much.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I've just seen a lot of people pretending like there is no launch stuff at all for this system, and that's not true. That's not the situation.
But the people that are saying that are the people who own the fucking Wii U's. Like, those are the people that are looking at it and saying, like, Nintendo is not giving me a reason to buy this fucking console, and I am the Nintendo man, because there's nothing else to play other than Zelda, and I already have a machine that can play Zelda. Like, those people are very frustrated.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
So, anyway, what else do we want to talk about with the Nintendo Switch? I think there's a couple other tech specs and online stuff.
Yeah, the online stuff is the major thing I want to touch, because I think there's some significant things to talk about with that. Because that is from...
We know very little.
We know very little, but what we do know is troubling, I would say. So they opened up the conference with like a lot of like the broader tech stuff, and that's where they talked about like the price and the launch date, and before that They talked about their online services, and this is one of those things that has taken a long time to narrow down what a lot of this stuff meant. And finally, like earlier today, I finally read something that was a confirmation from Reggie about how some of this stuff will work, which is, so they are ultimately going to charge people for online in a similar way that Xbox Live Gold and PS Plus does for like playing online multiplayer stuff. And using those sorts of online features. They have not said how much that is going to cost or anything. They have said that there is going to be like a trial period at first, and then I believe it's in the fall is when they're going to roll out the paid version. And so it's not like a trial period of like whenever you get a Switch, you have a trial period of like a couple of months or whatever. It is specifically the service itself is going to launch. When it launches, it is in a trial period, and then once that trial period ends in fall, it is from then on a paid service for anyone. That service is going to be given to you through a smartphone app. And through that app is how you're going to do things like party invite, like messages, and video game chat is going to be done through your smartphone, not through your console. Basically, all of their online features that they're asking you to pay for are not built into the OS, accessible through the OS of the system itself. It's accessible through an app that you download and pay to subscribe to on your phone, which to me sounds terrible.
I'm definitely inclined to say that. I want to see what this is and how it would work.
Yeah, but like given Nintendo's, let's say, less than stellar track record with their online stuff, that does not give you a lot of faith in what they're going to do going forward. And then when you hear on top of it that is going to be some sort of integration with your smartphone to your console, which is, I should say, other than the chat stuff, which is like, I have an app on my phone I can use to chat with people while I'm playing fucking video games. It's called Skype. Like, I do not need your app to do that. And you doing that takes away one of the key things about voice chat on consoles, which is that the fucking video game music, like sound and everything, and the voice chat come through the same channel if I have my headset plugged into, like, my DualShock 4. Like, that's a big thing that that service provides. And, like, having that move to your smartphone, there's no reason for me to use your version of fucking voice chat in video games. That's an insane thing to do. And I do want to just read a quote from Reggie, which is what I read like a little bit ago that has sort of confirmed this. And this is just where like, it just sounds so tone deaf. It says, instead of having some sort of bulky gamer headset, you will be able to do it right off your smartphone. Put in your earbuds that you use for your standard mobile device. We think that's a pretty sweet solution. That's part of the overall opportunity that we see in a subscription service. And some of that stuff he was talking about overall, that he's talking about other stuff earlier in that quote. But that is so fucking tone deaf. Because do you know if I have a modern Xbox One controller, the original Xbox One controller did launch with a proprietary input thing for their own chat things. But with a modern Xbox One controller or any era of the DualShock 4, do you know exactly what I can fucking do to do game chat?
You can plug in any...
Yeah. I can plug in any normal earbud. I can plug in the earbuds I use on my phone if I use my phone like that for a call on my phone, and I can plug that into my fucking controller, Reggie. Like, every time they have talked about their online stuff, it just feels like it gets worse and worse and worse, and like the idea of them asking you to pay for it, and like it is important that they haven't said how much they're going to pay, but I have to imagine it's going to be more than what you want to pay, you know? Like, that just sounds so like such a bad decision that unless they like 100% turn around the boat and like their online service is totally directly competitive and great and like has all the features that you want and the smartphone stuff works perfect and it's not a problem, unless that happens, like they're making a serious mistake by asking people to fucking pay for this kind of stuff.
I don't disagree with any of that necessarily.
Yeah.
I think there are ways that kind of smartphone integration could be really smart up to the level of game chat, which,
yeah,
you know, like, they're like, hey, I wish there was an easier smartphone app to do some of that stuff with Xbox sometimes, but you
know. I mean, because that is like the Smart Glass app for Xbox One and the PlayStation app that you can have on your smartphone. You can do stuff like send messages and stuff like that way. It's not a great way to do that stuff, which is one of the reasons why it feels like Nintendo's is probably not going to be... I mean, obviously, it's going to be more of a priority for them, but that's this kind of stuff that it feels like it would be so easy for some weird networking thing to go wrong between your phone and your console and sure, that for just not to work. There's so many ways in which that can not work when if you just did it all on the console the way it has been done since like the Xbox 360 or even like the original Xbox and the PS2. Like that stuff, there's a level of sort of like assuredness with that as long as those systems are built well on the console that there's not going to be some weird middleman that fails in that process, and building that app is just putting a middleman right there and then you're asking me to pay for that fucking app.
It's very strange. I want to see what it is. You know, if I want, you know, I wonder, there's enough ambiguity in what they've said that I don't know if it's exclusively all on the app or if it has to be or if they can change their minds. I can understand if they were going to say it's like a for an on-the-go kind of thing, because then you could use your cellular network and you don't have to have 3G in the thing. And that could be smart if they were pitching that side of it that way. But then if they also said at home you can just do it like a normal console, then you're talking, you know?
Yeah.
But that's not what they said.
That is not what they were saying at all.
So it's very strange, the entire strategy with that. I also, the question I desperately want answered is how will DRM work on this thing?
Uh-huh.
Because the way it's worked on the 3DS and Wii U is it's tied to the console itself, not necessarily to your ID. They've started to change that in that you can, you've for a year or two now, they've started doing that conversion process where you take your whatever ID you had before, it becomes your Nintendo Network ID, your My Nintendo login and stuff, and now you can like buy games online and it'll go to your console, and very modern in that way.
Yeah.
And so I would think it's possible they're moving towards that, but they didn't say anything about it. And I would be very disappointed if it's another case where with the Switch, if I buy a game digitally, I can't just download it to like two Switches or something.
Yeah.
You know, because there's certain things that I kind of like about the way they have storage on this thing. So it comes with 32 gigs as a base, but you can put it, internal memory. But you can use your micro SD cards, and that's good. That's a cheap, non-proprietary memory that you can put in and put as much in as you want. Up to, you know, those come into about 500 gigs now, and you could obviously even have a couple if somehow you had too many games for that.
Yeah.
So you know, there's things like that, but how much you want to buy digitally with Nintendo, you also kind of have to take your foot off the gas if it's going to be the exact same as it is on the 3DS and Wii U, and we don't know yet.
Yeah, and a lot of that online service stuff, like, that is exactly the stuff that I was, like, looking for this presentation of, like, how are you going to address this? Because this has been one of my biggest issues with Nintendo machines that I have used in the past, is I did not like dealing with online stuff at any point with any of your machines. That's one of the reasons why I never got a Wii U, is, like, seeing that stuff. And so, like, that's one of your things you need to fix. And for like one of the first things they said in the conference would be, and it's going to be a paid service that is handled through an app on your smart device. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then did not say anything else about it. It's like, this is where you need to have a strong, like, comprehensive presentation about, like, here is how our online stuff works. Here is how it, like, it is better than what we've done before. And like, why it's good and why you should pay for it. And it's like, so the stuff where like not bringing that stuff in depth at all is kind of what's so troubling about it, because as much as they had to say about it, Nintendo is the only video game company on the fucking planet that when they make a thing, they have to come out and say that you can play online multiplayer and send messages like it is a selling point. That's like, because they has not been a thing that they have done well in the past, and for them to have to reassure you that they are still technically doing that is a thing that they have to fucking say. Sony and Microsoft did not go up at the beginning of their conferences and say, and you can play online multiplayer on the PlayStation 4. They didn't need to say those words because everyone just assumed it. And so when you're in that position like Nintendo was, you need to give me something to reassure me that you're handling this well, and everything that they've said about it tells me that they are probably not handling well. And one of those other things, which is something they did not say in the conference, but since come out afterwards and there was a big kerfuffle about how this all worked and we now have it clarified, is to sort of justify, this is something else that Reggie said in that the quote that I've read, but it was cut off from the beginning, to justify how their online stuff is going to be paid, they're going to do something sort of nominally similar to what the PS Plus has been doing since the PS3 days, and Microsoft started doing with games with gold on the Xbox One, which is to offer you old games that you get for quote-unquote free as long as you're subscribed to the service. The thing is, the way they are handling it is each month you will get access to one NES or Super NES game for that month, And then once that month is over, you no longer have access to that game. And if you want to continue to have access to that game, you now have to go buy that game from the Virtual Console. And that is so unsatisfactory. That is so below what Sony and Microsoft are doing with their comparative services that this fucking online thing better be like $10 a year. Because if it is not, this is fucking insane.
Yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff we have yet to see. But definitely some of those core details, especially that one you said, if you're, you know, if you're putting your hands and eyes over your ears and everything, and you're saying, you know, there's nothing else. It's just Nintendo on an island. And you're like, oh, maybe that could be cool. But then obviously you see, no, we live in a world where you're competing with PS Plus and Xbox Live Games with Gold.
Yeah.
And
which like, both give you multiple games that like three games that came out in this generation of games that like then once you get them, as long as you subscribe to the service, you have them for in perpetuity until like Sony and Microsoft dissolve at some point in the future. It's like, and I'm not saying that like every game that is on those services is great. Like, I think that is an issue that Sony has had for a while now, is that they
played a PS Plus game in a year.
The PS4 is at a point where it has a library that is robust enough that they really need to start kicking up what they are offering on that service. But still, I would rather take Day of the Tentacle Remastered than to have like access to fucking Super Mario Brothers for a month. Like, we're talking about games that are like over 20 years old that they are saying that's like you will get access to one of them for a month. Like, are you? And a lot of those are presumably going to be games like Link to the Past. It's like, I have Link to the Past on the Game Boy Advance, or people have Link to the Past that they bought on Virtual Console before. Like, a lot of their really big marquee games, a lot of people already own them. So it's like, it's not a value add. And if you're asking people to now pay for this online service, and that's the one of the ways you're compensating them, it's like almost actively insulting that you're giving so little when you could give so much more of like, say, here's a, like, you get access to like this whole selection of Virtual Console titles that will then be like a rolling thing or something that changes each month instead of it being one game. Like, there's, people have been waiting for such a long time for Nintendo to find a smart way to sort of utilize their video game backwards catalog, that like their back catalog that is way more robust than any other fucking active big game developer right now. And this is not a way to do that well.
Yeah. Again, yeah, I'm curious if anything from this that we've learned so far, I feel like is likely to change before launch day, like their plans. Like, if they pull like the Xbox One 180 that they did back in the day, that's probably the area it's going to come in.
Yeah,
I feel like, you know, I could also see accessory prices dropping or something if they feel like they need to do that.
Maybe, but like the 3DS is a big exception, but in general, I find that like Nintendo's pretty does not like to price drop their stuff that much. Like,
yeah, I'm just saying I could see that almost as a reverse before it's out in stores than once it's actually out. Because once it's actually out, then I agree, they don't tend to price drop. In fact, I think it was Kotaku pointed out that the Wii U has technically never had a price drop.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, you can get them for relatively cheap, but you have to get them used.
Yeah.
This is, like, really weird.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's the Nintendo Switch. Let's wrap up with some final thoughts.
Yeah.
Look, I'm going to be frank here. If I could design the world, I would love to live in a world where Nintendo just made games, and those games came out on the PS4 or the Xbox One, and that's how you played it, because that's what they do better than anyone else in the business, and I'd like to see them continue doing that, and it would be nice if that was the easy way they did it, and that'd be great, maybe with a portable thing on the side, because other people don't make portable systems anymore.
Yeah.
But in the ideal world, I do think that would be the ideal system we live in, where Nintendo is good at this thing, and they do that, and Sony and Microsoft are good at this thing, and they do that. And that'd be great. We don't live in that world.
No.
And we're not going to live in that world, at least for some time, if ever. So, in the world we live in, I continue to be excited for this. I think the Switch as a piece of hardware is something I'm very excited for. Considering that some of the things it looks like it's not doing well are the things I've never really looked to Nintendo to do, it's not going to impact my life greatly, and it doesn't disappoint me that much. Like, even if the internet stuff, the online functionality was a hot mess, I don't play Nintendo games online. So, you know, would I like to live in a world where they could do that? Sure. You know, maybe this is a paid service I don't even need to buy or something, you know, when that comes out. And whatever. I mean, I've even frankly thought of canceling my PS Plus because I play so few PlayStation games online and they don't release good games on PS Plus anymore. So, you know, some of that has entered my mind too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I've thought about cutting back on that. But look, I saw some games I really liked. I know Nintendo's going to release good games. I love the idea of the Switch. It's kind of At its core, what that thing is something I've always wanted. I'm excited to have that, and I was going to buy Nintendo's next console anyway, so, yeah. I don't know.
For me, I'm someone that I have spent the last, like, 15 or something years of my life so desperately wanting to play Nintendo's games and love what Nintendo does, and every once in a while I get to play something, but, like, for a very long time, since basically have probably like halfway through the Wii's life cycle, like Nintendo has just been frustrating me at every single turn of that, like, they still make good games, but they everything else about what they do is just bad enough that I am not going to fucking pay $300 as a premium to get access to your good games. Like, I'm not going to fucking do that. I want to play Zelda really bad. I like that Mario game is probably going to be really great, and I want to play that too. But like, I'm not going to buy a console for $300, and plus, like, and then have to like pay all the money to buy those games and the controllers and stuff. I want to play two fucking games. Like, I don't. Not going to do that. And if there are more, maybe I will get it in the future. Who knows?
There's going to be more.
There's going to be more. Is there going to be a volume of more that I'm actually going to want to get this console? Something I don't know. Because that never reached that point with the Wii U for me. And so,
I get it. But, you know, another thing for me with these things is that there are a lot of games I wouldn't know about if I didn't have the system and was in the market to get it. But, you know, look, there are certain things that Nintendo annoys me with, definitely on their hardware side. It is also, if I'm just playing a game, it's oftentimes when I'm open up my 3DS or something, that's kind of still in some ways the easiest, just I'm going to just play a game here, because it's still kind of free of some of the bullshit of modern gaming in some ways. And there are good things that come with that and bad things that come with that. But I just, for me personally, don't want to discount how much of my gaming life is still on Nintendo systems. And that I don't think they've become, I understand there are frustrations. I don't think those frustrations are enough to leave them irrelevant in that way.
They're not irrelevant, but there are so many other things I can be doing that, like, games I already own, books I want to read, movies I want to see. Like, there's so much other stuff I can be spending my time on, and I don't have, like, a ludicrous amount of money to just throw around, and I am not going to throw down $300 for a console. Like, unless, like, eventually, hopefully, the rest of Nintendo's, like, development force comes to the Switch. Like, if the Switch is successful and has all of that, then maybe, like, a year from now when Mario is about to come out and the Switch is, like, $250 if it gets price dropped or something, maybe I do jump in on it. Like, maybe at some point in the future, this becomes, like, a much better choice. But right now, I came into this, like, excited about the Nintendo Switch and, like, in a position where I felt like Nintendo just has to not fuck up stuff, and then they can get me on their side, because their initial pitch was so strong. And I felt for a lot of this presentation, it felt like even if it was a bunch of minor stuff, they kept on fucking up enough minor stuff that it just kept on pushing me away and away and away, just enough to be like, you know what, I want to play Zelda really bad. I don't want to play Zelda that bad. I will spend my time doing other stuff that I also want to do.
Maybe I can lend you my Wii U.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Like, I would love to be able to play it. But yeah, Nintendo, I want to fucking play your game so bad, but not quite that bad. I'm still in a position where, like, one, like, on a fucking clock, once a month, I will constantly check and look and, like, look at a 3DS online and get so close to buying it and just, like, just back off another, because it's like, that's just still, it's just a little too expensive. Don't quite want to do it. And, like, I'm in that position where it's like, I am definitely on the edge, but, like, it's not I feel like they don't present a strong enough, like, sort of cohesive, holistic thing that, and, like, a strong enough sort of front that convinces me that this is something I want to get on right away. Again, I'm totally open to getting it at some point in the future.
Okay, I get this with launch, with the Switch, totally. Yeah. With the 3DS thing, that's you at that point, though, right? That's not
sure.
The 3DS.
Yeah, no, that's not the 3DS. But, like, that's why I'm saying of, like, I want to play Nintendo games really, really bad. But
you,
it's like, there's
could.
Enough.
There is a system that is relatively cheap
that
has an
but,
insane,
like,
catalog at this point.
But it is, like, but if I want to get, because, well, here's my problem with the 3DS stuff, is that, like, because they put the new Nintendo 3DS out, I don't want to buy an old Nintendo 3DS, but the new Nintendo 3DS is still too expensive for me to want to get it when, like, I know I'm, like, I really want to play Fire Emblem and Pokemon and stuff, but those games are just old enough that, like, I'm probably going to fall off, not quite finish them and stuff like that. Like, it's not...
Get a 2DS, $79.99.
If I'm not going to buy an old 3DS because I am too much would want to buy the new thing, it would kind of, like, always in the back of my mind, I would be annoyed because I knew there was a better version of the thing that like I could have bought and didn't buy. I'm definitely not going to buy a 2DS.
Okay. Again, I don't know how that's a Nintendo problem at this
point.
It
is partially a me problem. I mean, obviously, it's a relationship between me and the company. But I am saying that, like, I am at this weird point in my life that I've been for a long time where Nintendo has enough stuff that I do kind of want to play, but, like, not a strong enough, like, sort of whole ecosystem and everything like that that makes me want to sort of, like, pay that big premium of buying this device just to play those games when like there is a just insane ludicrous plethora of amazing games on the PS4 that I have not even fucking played. Like that, like the PS4 has such an insane robust history of like such a diverse broad titles from all these different game developers from all over the world. It's like I can't justify paying $300 to buy this machine to play games made by, like, I mean, obviously they have a bunch of different developers in Nintendo, but like effectively games from one developer that tend to be very specific kind of games, because I am also not a big fan of platformers, so like that kind of kills a part of the Nintendo offering to me.
I get,
you know.
It. Yeah.
Because also, another part of it is I did get burned really fucking hard on Twilight Princess, and that it still hurts to this day.
You have to let that go at some point.
No, I will not.
Okay, that's a stupid complaint at this point.
It hurts.
A certain point, there is, I'm just trying to point out, there's an intersection of you and this hardware, and it's not.
No, obviously, there's a, like, of course, there's an intersection with you and the hardware where you're this insane Nintendo fan, so you're going to buy it no matter, like, fucking, they could make you.
But I copped to that. Like, that was the first thing I
you
said.
Should have to shove a fucking banana up your ass to buy the next Donkey Kong game, and you would do it.
I don't love the Donkey Kong games that much. Okay. Maybe if there's enough
for a Mario game. To be able to get to New Donk City, you would do that.
If they announce Metroid Prime 4 tomorrow, bananas going up my ass. Absolutely.
Yeah. So obviously it's an intersection between me and the console, but like and Nintendo. But like there is a world in which Nintendo is like does make that full argument for me to make me want to go buy the machines, because I used to live in that world. I had a GameCube. Like I was the one who wanted to get the GameCube for our family.
Okay.
You know, like I fucking got a Wii. You know.
Well, everyone
that
got a Wii.
That didn't turn out super well for me because I really did not play a lot of games on the Wii.
Wii's a great system. There's a lot of good games.
It has good games. Don't love the system so much.
I like the system just fine, but I'm interested for this. I've got mine on pre-order. I want to talk about the pre-order process really quick.
Okay.
Because this was a little weird. It was not the most painful pre-order process ever by any means. I mean, it was as long as within the first 24 hours you could find it somewhere, you know, to pre-order.
Yeah.
And that first night it went up on Best Buy is where I was able to get a pre-order of. I don't love ordering stuff from Best Buy, but it's better than nothing, you know. So I'll have one on launch day unless something goes terribly wrong. But it is weird that there was kind of no, like, unified front on where the... Like, they just started, like, after the conference, they just started going up kind of in random places at random times. Amazon, once again, if anyone was trying to rely on order from them, was super frustrating. And you should never... Amazon is not where you should look for first for hardware of anything, because that's just not their business, right? But it was kind of weird that there was just no, like, this is the date when it's going to go on pre-order or something, which I very distinctly remember being like, that's how the 3DS and Wii U and other Nintendo games and obviously the PS4, Xbox One have worked. So that was a little weird. It seemed, and I would not be surprised, of course, if between now and March 3rd, I think there will probably be another round of pre-orders opening. I can't imagine this is all they have to sell, because even for Nintendo, that'd be weird. You know, I'm sure it will be supply constrained at launch just because a lot of that will go towards pre-orders. But it is funny that, you know, Nintendo Switch, big launch, a lot of people excited for it, a high interest kind of thing. I was able to get a pre-order with relative ease, and I still cannot get an NES Classic anywhere. It would be, I don't know, easier to breathe for 5 minutes underwater than find an NES Classic.
Hey, Jonathan, if you're very patient, you can have a 1/30th of that NES Classic. Over the course of that Switch lifetime, each month you get another 30th of it, but you have to let the old 30th go away.
I'm not saying I even necessarily want an NES Classic. Yeah. It's just bizarre. And one of the things I had kept hearing is that part of why the NES Classic is so supply constrained is Nintendo was using most of its channels to produce Switches, which is good. Maybe for Nintendo Switches. Maybe don't launch the NES Classic if you can't get supply out there.
Like, you can want the NES Classic whenever you want. Like, that is, you know, this magical item that is based on nostalgia. Like, you could fucking re-release that 50 years from now and people are still going to go apeshit for it.
It's just so bizarre. Like, we haven't talked about the NES Classic much on here. It is so bizarre that thing is still... It is middle of January.
Yeah.
That thing came out in, like, October. You still cannot get one. That is so weird, especially for this thing that was poised to be like the stocking stuffer of the holiday. No one got that thing for Christmas because no one got it, period.
Yeah.
So I do not understand their strategy for that, and I guess it just was one part of the hand of the company not talking to the other. It happens to everyone at different points. Yeah. But it was a very bizarre thing, especially now that, you know, I have a Switch comfortably on pre-order, but no NES Classic. Yeah. And that's their $60 little thing that probably takes nothing to produce.
Yeah, like, I feel like you could make that in your fucking garage with you a motherboard and, like, enough, like, painted plastic.
A lot of people, there's a huge fan community in Nintendo who are learning about the Raspberry Pi and making things.
Yeah, like no, that. Actually, that was a fucking stupid thing to say. It's like, it's not that you can make an NES Classic in your garage. It's that you can make a thing that can play every single NES and Super Nintendo game in your garage for about the amount of money you would spend to buy a fucking NES Classic.
And there's an obvious appeal to the NES Classic.
Yeah.
But it's like, it is, yeah, the whole thing is so weird. And, yeah, I hope everyone who wants to get a Switch on launch day can get that pre-ordered, and I'm sure a lot of people have. It doesn't seem like the most disastrous pre-order process yet, though who knows what could go wrong. It is, I guess the only other thing to talk about is with the launch SKUs they have.
Yeah.
You know, the main gray one and then the dual color thing.
Yeah, it's fine. Red and blue.
It is weird that there's not some kind of bundle with a controller or a game or something.
Yeah.
I
think it's because it came in at that $300 price point, like, for what that thing is in, like, the market is entering into with, like, whether, like, it is that way for you or not, like, it does exist in competition with the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One. Like, that is the market it enters. And so it's, like, the Switch cannot come in at a price point in any SKU that is above the MSRP of the PS4 and the Xbox One. So it's, like, they're just in a position where, like, that thing is clearly coming in, like, as cheap as they can have it because it doesn't come in with a bundled-in game.
Right.
And it doesn't, like, come in with any, like, cool extra stuff or a premium SKU that has more memory or something.
And, look, part of this is why I'm so excited about this thing, for better or for worse. I'm just so curious because there hasn't ever been anything like this.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of why I feel like a lot of the things around it, obviously Nintendo could just do better with some of their messaging and stuff, but some of it's also like, it's such a weird position for them to be in launching this thing, because $299 is on the historic low side for a home console launch.
Sure, yeah.
Right? But you can still have that conversation of, in some ways it seems too high, because it's this weird hybrid thing, it's entering mid-generation. There's so many different sides to it that are so complicated. That's what kind of makes me so excited to see, what is this thing when I have it in my hands? How does it do with the larger public? What is the general reception going to be? You know, it's a console launching in March, not in November or December. There's so many different things that are different, fundamentally different about this versus not just Nintendo, but the larger video game community.
Yeah, and I am so fascinated by, like, what the business ramifications of this thing are going to be. Like, obviously, like, while I'm not buying a Switch, I am in no way saying that I think the Switch is going to be a complete failure. Like, I really have no idea how well this thing is going to do. Like, I think I can see a world in which it's extremely popular. I can also see a world in which it does barely better than the Wii U. Like, I have fucking no idea.
I agree. I think that spectrum is super wide, and I think even Nintendo's probably thinking, like, this could go either way. Because I think, you know, this press conference, whatever, that press conference was never going to reach the widest audience, obviously.
Yeah.
So it really is going to come down to their moment-to-moment, day-to-day marketing. And clearly from that first video, they have a very strong pitch they can put together for this thing.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, you know, solid. And it's going to see, you know, throughout the year, it might benefit them that this is going to be a fairly quiet year on the hardware side for the PS4 and Xbox One until we get to fall. And then there's maybe the Scorpio, depending on what that is. We don't know. The PS4 Pro obviously did not make huge waves, so that's not going to be like a big competitor kind of thing. So, yeah, I agree. I think it could go either. This could be the next coming of the Wii or on that. Not maybe that level, but something like that. Maybe the next coming of the DS. I don't know. Well, DS is the most successful console ever, tied with the PS2. So maybe that's a bad comparison.
Yeah.
But I could see it like the DS, in so much as the DS was not an overnight success. It was definitely an organic growing one. I could see it doing that very easily.
I definitely think it's going to be fairly popular in Japan.
Yes.
Which is like, you know, Nintendo is a very Japan-focused company because it's a Japanese company. It's a very traditional sort of Japanese company in that way. But I'm curious to see, like, I think it is going to do very well. I think it's going to do better than the PS4 and the Xbox One in Japan overall. Like, if you look at, like, the relative monthly sales and stuff like that. But I am curious, like, if it can make a very big dent in the overall trend in the Japanese gaming market, which is going super heavy on the mobile side, like, even more so than with, like the Vita and 3DS are doing better in Japan, like, relatively than in the rest of the world. But even they are losing out to the mobile gaming market over there. So yeah. I'm really curious to see if that's going to make a big change for that or not.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you can't talk about the Switch without talking about a lot of it is from the Japanese culture and community that this is oriented.
I mean, there's a reason why this big presentation came out of Japan, was done in Japanese, and like translated to English for everyone else. You know?
So, going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to March 3rd.
I'm also looking forward to March 3rd, even if I'm not getting it. I want to hear all the stuff that comes out about this thing.
Yep, and I'll just say for my personal gaming calendar, they picked a good date, because I don't have anything else pressing like right on that date.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I don't think Mass Effect's actually going to come out on March 21st.
No.
But if somehow it does, it's at least later in the month, and then Persona's a month later. So, you know, we're relatively well positioned for these things. Yeah,
it is coming out spread out enough. Like, it is one of it's nice. We are in this nice period where, like, you know, Gravity Rush 2 comes out next week, and then it's not that long until, like, other. I mean, Yakuza 0 just came out, and I'm weirdly tempted to get that game too.
Yeah,
like I like this feeling of, like, hey, games are coming out, and it's January. You know, like, it's not this weird thing of that you have nothing to play until fucking October.
Right. All right. Well, we have lots of stuff to play. We will be talking about Gravity Rush 2 next time, I'm sure, at least a little bit. Maybe we'll push the podcast back a couple days to talk about it, because that's a Friday launch, which is weird.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, as we were joking about before the podcast started, this is our last podcast under President Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So our last podcast under a truly democratically elected leader. That's nice.
Yep. So, and also, as I was telling you before the podcast, I'm super excited for the fascist version of the podcast. I think it's going to really change our sort of perspective on Gravity Rush 2 when we come at it from like a, hey, who's this like stupid girl flying around using her superpowers to try to help people? Like, she should be submitting to the will of the state, really.
Yeah, she should be going around taking health care from those people.
Exactly, yes, indeed. With her gravity powers.
Yeah, so once we become an arm of the Trump propaganda network next week.
I think it's a bright future ahead of us. I don't know, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think we had a really good podcast today, Jonathan. I thought we did a good job. I liked, we talked about a series of unfortunate events. And then we also talked about that Netflix series, huh? Ha ha!
Fucking shit.
Yeah.